blamed it on you.
Oh, you brat.
Members of the public, I'm Brian McFadden, for the record, and I'm an engineer on your staff. And
you just were bad at that thing.
I'd like to give you an overview of where we're at in developing and implementation, implementing the Scott River TMDL. And to do that, I'm going to briefly summarize the TMDL, discuss the conditional waiver that's part of that, and summarize our efforts to implement that TMDL. Scott River TMDLs were adopted by the US EPA on September 8, 2006, and at that time, the timelines began to take effect. The Scott River is impaired by elevated stream temperatures and excess sediment, and the TMDLs were developed to address those impairments. The specific categories of activities that the TMDL addresses are roads, both private and public, grading activities, timber harvest activities, grazing and riparian issues, and issues with water use and bank stabilization. I'd like to now talk about the conditional waiver that was adopted after the TMDL. The state non-point source policy restates that all discharges of waste need to be covered by a permit, and in the case of non-point source discharges, that's either a waste discharge requirement or a waiver thereof. During the adoption process, the state board conditioned their adoption on your adoption of a conditional waiver that would allow, that would create compliance with the non-point source policy. And so we went ahead and developed that waiver, and this board adopted the waiver. So what that waiver does is it provides permit coverages, coverage for discharges that aren't already covered by an existing program. But it's conditioned on participation in an ongoing collaborative process, and those individuals who are taking action to comply with the TMDL are covered by the waiver. However, what the waiver doesn't do is provide landowners coverage on activities that are already covered by an existing program, such as the NPDES program, or 401 certs, or timber waste discharge requirements. So now I'd like to kind of summarize real briefly what we've been doing since adoption of the TMDL. The first step that we took was to develop a work plan, and we submitted a draft, circulated a draft, and solicited comments and incorporated many of those comments, and then brought it back to this board. And since then, it's finalized, and we've been working through the work plan. As Kat said, we've developed implementation teams internally with representation from the relevant programs in our office. We've been doing a lot of education and outreach, and that's been the majority of our effort to date, and I'll explain that in more detail later in our program. We've also been coordinating with other agencies. I've spent a lot of time in working with the county and the RCD to get the Scott River Groundwater Study Plan off and running, and as part of that, there was a contract that had to be developed, and I've also developed another contract that's taken some of my time with the RCD for education outreach. Again, I'll be talking about that in a little more detail later. We've also been identifying water quality issues that we think are immediately addressable, and approaching landowners about those issues. And Andy's going to update you later about that. And now Andy's going to give you an overview of where we're at with the Shasta.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. I'm Andrew Baker, and your staff, and I'm the lead in implementing the Shasta River TMDL. We're celebrating our six-month anniversary since the TMDL was adopted in January. It's state law now, and it also includes a conditional waiver like the Scott. And it's listed as impaired due to elevated stream temperatures and low dissolved oxygen levels. The TMDL implementation plan is designed to increase riparian shade, prevent irrigation return flows or tailwater flows, increase dedicated cold water to the Shasta River, remove or re-engineer minor impoundments or small diversion dams, reduce nitrogen discharges from Dwinnell Dam, the Wairika sewage treatment plant, and also from stormwater and urban or suburban areas, stormwater discharges from urban and suburban areas. So I'm going to go over real quickly what the requirements are for the TMDL, and we're going to get a progress report from some speakers later on the progress that we've made. So I'm going to try to do this pretty quickly. Parties conducting grazing or landowners with land adjacent to streams must minimize the discharge of fine sediment, nutrients, and other oxygen-consuming materials, and they must also increase riparian shade along streams to reduce stream temperatures. So landowners must submit annual compliance or progress reports beginning next January 2008, and the executive officer will report to you on the progress in January 2009, and will update you on any needs for changes in the program. The responsible parties must achieve compliance by January 2017. That means they need to have made good faith efforts to increase riparian shade and reduce discharges from grazing activities. So irrigators with return flows or tailwater discharges must reduce these discharges to prevent increased stream temperatures and the discharge of nutrients and other oxygen-consuming materials. And they have to report annually, give progress reports beginning January of 2008. The EO must provide a status report on this progress beginning January 2009. And the Regional Water Board will adopt waste discharge requirements or waivers as needed beginning January 2012. Tailwater discharges must comply with water quality standards for the TMDL by the year 2017. So water diverters, they must employ practices to increase dedicated cold water to reduce stream temperatures in the Shasta by January 2009, and again January 2011. They shall provide a progress report to you on what they have achieved. Diverters shall comply with a final strategy report to the Regional Board 2012. And if these measures fail, if we don't reduce stream temperatures, then State Water the Regional Board can petition the State Water Resources Control Board to modify water rights decrees. So with minor impoundments, they need to be removed or re-engineered to reduce sediment oxygen demand behind the impoundments, and they got to provide a progress report to you by 2008. We're making pretty good progress here, and we'll get an update on that from the RCD following my presentation. So Montague Water Conservation District must report to the Regional Water Board on a plan to bring the discharge from Donnell into compliance with water quality standards by January 2009. And Montague Water Conservation District, City of Lee, Siskiyou County, Caltrans, Winchestina Communities, U.S. Forest Service, BLM, private timber companies must complete a study and a plan addressing water quality conditions in Winchestina by January 2009. They shall begin implementing the plan by 2012. City of Yreka must comply with existing regional board orders to bring the sewage treatment plant into compliance with water quality standards and reduce the discharge of nutrients into Yreka Creek. So, urban and suburban runoff, responsible parties must identify pollutants and their sources, and by January 2009, responsible parties shall develop a plan to minimize the discharge of nutrients and oxygen-consuming materials. And by January 2012, submit the plans to you, the Regional Board, for review and approval. For activities on federal land, which include timber harvest activities, grazing, road maintenance, and other activities, we're going to develop an MOU with the Forest Service, and Bob Clamp is going to update you later on that. For timber harvest on private land or non-federal land, we're going to use our existing program, and again, Bob Clamp will address that. For Caltrans, we're going to work with them on their stormwater program. We've already begun working with them, done some field work, and we're going to review that program and continue periodic review, and we have Caltrans here today to give you a report on that. So in summary, we're going to support the ongoing efforts, the extensive efforts that have been done to date to restore the Shasta River. We're going to work hard with all the other agencies and stakeholders to protect and restore riparian vegetation, prevent tailwater discharges, increase stream flows, and remove or upgrade impoundments. Over time, we're going to review the effectiveness of the program and make recommendations to you. And also part of our program is to take permitting and enforcement actions as necessary. We're going to talk a little bit more about that later. So that's it for now. Any questions?
Board Member Watson. Mr. Chairman, thank you. Andy, under the best case scenarios, with the implementation plan that you hope to, or that we hope to put into place, how much decrease in water temperature can we anticipate, assuming that everybody does the best work possible? Are we able to have a significant impact on water temperature?
Yes. I think we need at least 2 degrees reduction. If Matt's here, maybe he can expand on that.
And I'd be curious how you establish that quantification.
Yeah, Matt's the one that developed the team deal. I would rather he spoke to that.
I'd be happy to speak to it. We had, before your appointment, we had numerous workshops and a hearing on the adoption of the TMDL. In brief summary, our analysis identified the potential to reduce maximum stream temperatures by about 5 degrees C. 3 degrees, approximately two-thirds of the reduction is due to riparian shading improvements and control of irrigation return flows such that they don't contribute to heating of the Shasta River temperatures. The additional one-third in the reduction in maximum stream temperatures is attributed to the increase of dedicated in-stream cold water flow.
So two-thirds is riparian shading improvements and controlling the irrigated tailwater returns?
That's right.
And the remaining third is increasing dedicated stream flows?
Yeah, I mean, that's on an average overall snapshot picture, but it gives you a sense of the conclusions that we reached in the TMDL.
And just so most folks know, 5 degrees centigrade is 9 degrees Fahrenheit?
Yes.
Okay. No further questions.
Any other board member have questions? I just had one, and perhaps it'll come up elsewhere, but obviously the RCDs are key players, and I assume we're working also with the incidental take permit, HCP's process. Are we coordinating with that?
Yes, we are, and we're going to update you on that in this workshop.
Okay.
So with that, we will turn it over to our other speakers, the RCDs. Yes, Mr. Anderson?
Are we collecting temperature data?
Yes, we are collecting some. We're still developing our monitoring program for the Shasta River.
Mr. Chair, just to follow on that question on temperature data, I have received anecdotal evidence, and I was just curious if your data would correlate. There are areas where there's substantial increases in temperatures within a very short time or distance from a source of a stream. Are you seeing that? From what I'm hearing, temperature increases in the range of 6 to 10 degrees or higher just within maybe 100 feet from the source. Are you seeing that in the data, or are you collecting that kind of information?
I have not seen recent data that shows that. When in developing the TMDL, we had some thermal infrared imagery work done, which gives a snapshot picture. In that data set, you do see some locations where you have quite significant increase in temperature over a short reach. The order of a couple hundred meters that you just mentioned would be surprising to me, but there are certainly reaches where we were seeing in the order of several miles increases of, I think, 6 degrees or so.
And do you distinguish between surface temperature and then maybe temperature of the water at deeper, like maybe a couple of feet below the surface?
Well, the thermal infrared imagery does not.
That's just surface. Right.
Temperature, when we deploy temperature monitoring probes, they are deployed by design in locations that are well mixed, and getting a representation of the overall kind of reach average across the cross section. So that should represent both the spatial top to bottom difference in temperature.
Yeah, because I've been in both rivers, and I know that when you initially step in, it's fairly warm. But when you go deeper, even in running areas of these rivers, it's much cooler 4 or 5 feet below the surface than it is at the surface. And I'm just curious if we take that into account when we're implementing some of these plans. And just from my observation, there are fish at that lower level in the river.
I'd like to address that. First off, in the thermal infrared imagery, one of the goals of our source analysis was to link our in-stream measurements with the thermal infrared, and we specifically collected information to verify that surface temperature was representative of the temperature of the entire water column, and that was the case. As far as the temperature of the bottom being cooler than the top. That sometimes happens in deep pools or where there's groundwater upwelling. And groundwater upwelling was something that we did take into account explicitly in the Scott TMDL, where that does occur to a great degree, but less so in the Shasta.
Okay, any further questions? I just had one on tailwater. First of all, until we get the groundwater, we really need to make sure we aren't dewatering. But what's the difference in the ambient temperature in the streams between the evening and the day? And does that make any difference if it's a night return versus a day?
I'm sorry, Mr. Corbett, I'm not sure I understand the question.
Well, ambient air temperature is obviously a key a factor of river temperature. What's the variation between night and day?
Diurnal yeah. variation in stream temperatures. Brian, do you have a recollection? I mean, I'd say it can be as high as 6 or 7 degrees C.
Certainly. Yeah. And it really is site dependent.
Yeah.
So it's hard to be general. But where there's less flow and less shade, we see wide swings in temperature throughout the day.
Okay. Any other board questions?
Department of Fish and Game. Mr. Good afternoon, members of the board and members of the public. My name is Caitlin Bean. I'm a staff environmental scientist with the Department of Fish and Game, and I am responsible for coordinating the development of the watershed-wide permitting programs in the Shasta and the Scott River Valleys. I'm going to give you a little bit of background, how we got where we are, and talk a little bit about the two programs that fall under the permit program umbrella. There's an incidental take permit program and a stream adulteration agreement program. And then I'll spend a few minutes talking about where we're at with CEQA and what our anticipated timeline is. So why are we doing this? Aside from the fact that it would be very difficult for the department to administer over 100 individual permits in each of the valleys. And aside from the fact that it would be very difficult for many of the landowners to afford obtaining permits, and aside from the fact that the economies of scale allow us to implement more effective coho recovery activities. There are two specific drivers to the development of these programs, and one is that through the listing process, the commission identified the Shasta and Scott River Valleys as a pilot project to test this approach. And through the development of that idea, they a specific recovery team was convened, the Shasta Scott Recovery Team, SSRT, and they developed coho recovery tasks that were specific to this area. And those tasks are a chapter of the state's recovery strategy. And in the development of the document they submitted to the commission for inclusion in the strategy, they required the development of a permit program to implement the tasks, the recovery tasks, while bringing specifically agricultural operators into compliance with the Fish and Game Code. And this was for routine agricultural activities or normal ranching activities. So where are we with the incidental take permits? We received applications for the programs from each of the RCDs on March 31st in 2005. That was quite strategic because COHO were listed the next day officially. The department deemed those applications complete. And then we conducted a mass mailing to reach out to diverters that we had information about through the tax assessor's database. These are just diverters that that had water master service. We wanted to inform them about the code and our intention to develop this program and to determine how many of those parties might be interested in participating in the program. And so we refer to those forms that they returned to us as their letters of intent. And we received, I would say it's about 90% or more of the diverters that we were able to access did say that they were interested in participating in the program. So we spent the last couple years developing these permitting documents, and we initiated our CEQA analysis about a year ago. So how are these programs structured? Well, we are very fortunate to have two RCDs that were willing to step forward as program administrators. In addition to administering the programs, though, they will be implementing the restoration work. So for the purposes of that work, they're also permittees. They will require participants to enter into a contractual agreement with them regarding program implementation. But the department will still be issuing permits directly to each landowner. We're calling these sub-permits because their analysis is contemplated in the permits that we're issuing to the RCD. All the activities that we're requiring will have been analyzed. So it's a 10-year program, 10-year permit with an adaptive management review during the fifth year. As I mentioned, the RCDs would administer the programs, conduct the monitoring, and submit annual reports to the department. But in addition to that, they've also agreed to implement the mitigation measures. These are measures above and beyond those measures that landowners could generally conduct on their property. The sub-permittees are responsible for implementing avoidance and minimization measures, and I have a list of what those activities are. But I want to make clear that the RCDs don't have regulatory authority in the program. So there's 14 covered activities in the incidental take permit program. The first 10 are also the same exact covered activities in the Streamhead Alteration Agreement program. So, briefly, we would cover the diversion of water in accordance with a legal water right, the maintenance and implementation of water diversion structures, with the caveat that all structures would need to meet Fish and Game Code statutes, all Fish and Game Code statutes within 5 years if they're not already in compliance. The construction and management of fish screens, stream access and crossings that may be developed to minimize or avoid impacts to spawning gravels, the implementation of riparian exclusion area fencing, riparian restoration activities, implementation of habitat structures for fish, including large woody debris or gravel constrictors, the construction of stream gauges, barrier removal and fish passage projects, grazing livestock, but only under very specific conditions that it would improve aquatic and riparian habitat values, Water management is in there because DWR is a sub-permittee to this permit, so the operation of head gates is a covered activity. And then the last three are sort of catch-all activities. What I want to point out regarding the list of activities is that most of them are restoration activities. So what are the sub-permittees required to do? First of all, to comply with their water rights and to provide verification regarding the quantity of the water that they're diverting. And this is where this will be related to DWR sub-permit when I get to that point. They'll be required to have a locking head gate and a gauge to measure the amount of water that they're diverting. They'll have to have fish screens in operation at all time. They have to provide fish passage at their diversions. The crossings, again, are necessary to focus the access of cattle and to prevent the impact of cattle on spawning gravels. Exclusion fencing of the riparian zone, bank stabilization, tailwater capture, and in the Scott River Valley specifically, in two of the tributaries, they're required to maintain connectivity with the main stem up until a certain point of the season. The RCD has agreed to fulfill the mitigation obligations, as I mentioned before, including the development of a water trust that would be used to purchase and or lease water rights to improve fish habitat, implement flow enhancement measures, including water use efficiency projects that would result in an in-stream dedication for water beneficial uses for fish. They're going to prepare a contingency plan for how to deal with all the issues, competing needs during dry years. More so in the Scott River Valley, will these alternative stockwater systems be developed? But you may know that stockwater rights allow ranchers to continue diverting quite a bit of water just for watering cows in the winter. But we think that there are more efficient ways to get water to their cows than taking water from the river. Spawning gravel enhancement, the construction of in-stream habitat improvement projects, riparian planting, and then the barrier removal projects are those large, you know, some of those large mitigation projects I mentioned. I mean, the things that really tip the scale. So on the Shasta Valley side, the first three projects here, the Arujo, Shasta Water Association, and Grenada diversions, are fish passage issues, and they've been working diligently in removing those. And then on the Scott River side, the Scott Valley Irrigation District fish ladder, Farmer's Ditch, and Rail Creek. Maybe you'll see some of those tomorrow, I don't know. So as a sub-permittee, DWR is agreeing to provide data to the department on a monthly basis that shows where they've, the sites that they visited, when they visited them, how much water was being diverted when they got there, and a number of other things. They will submit this data to us in the form of a database, and they will assure that folks are operating within their water rights. A third element of their sub-permit is that if they are aware of a situation where stranding might occur at the point of diversion, they would notify us and we would coordinate regarding the best way to resolve that issue, including the possibility of reducing the volume of water being diverted. So there's three types of monitoring that the RCD has agreed to conduct, each RCD. Compliance monitoring, just meaning, did the sub-permittee do what they said they were going to do? Implementation monitoring, meaning, Here it is before the fish screen, here it is after the fish screen was built. And effectiveness monitoring, meaning is it functioning the way that we intended it to function? This is critical information for us for when we do our adaptive management review. So regarding the streamlet alteration agreement part of the program, this is just a little bit of the statute that I have here on this slide regarding the fact that all of the diverters, anyone who substantially diverts needs to notify the department to determine if they need a streamlet alteration agreement. A determination has been made that in these valleys, all diverters need a streamlet alteration agreement. So the program will function much the same way as the existing fish and game streamlet alteration program functions. An applicant would submit a notification to the department, and the department would enter into an agreement with that party. And the point I'm trying to make here is that the RCD will participate in terms of support to landowners, but they aren't taking on an extra role regarding this program, aside from that assistance. So we have four driving documents that create this program. One's a memorandum of understanding between ourselves and the RCDs that just defines roles and responsibilities and the process for a landowner to obtain an agreement, or for the RCD for that matter, for the restoration projects. Attached to the memorandum of understanding is a master list of terms and conditions. And this document includes the covered activities. They're completely consistent with activities from the install take permit, with the exception of those last four conditions. Then there's general there's general conditions that apply to all sub-permittees, and these have to do with mostly administrative elements of the program. And then there's specific conditions that are sort of like a smorgasbord of choices of mitigation measures. And I think in our last count there was about 100 of those. They are, we tried to group them so that if, for instance, if you have, if you have, obviously if you're diverting, there's a number of specific conditions that go to that activity. If you need to implement a crossing, there's a number of specific conditions that go to that activity. So this is a way for us to essentially identify all the possible conditions. We have the authority to add conditions or modify conditions when it comes time to negotiating those individual sub-permits, but this is a way to get it all out on the table so everybody can see what the requirements are. Then we have a very a notification package that's specific to these two programs, the Shasta and the Scott, and we will be requiring landowners to sign a right of entry agreement. Some landowners have diversions that occur on their neighbor's property, but we will need to have access for monitoring and specifically for compliance. And we need to get that up front. So, as I mentioned, the department will issue agreements directly to the individual diverters and, in addition, directly to the RCDs when their restoration projects fit into the cover activities. The fees have already been paid, and the CEQA analysis will have been completed by the time, so we expect this to be an expedited process for the landowners. Because the issuance of streamlet alteration agreements and install take permits is a discretionary action by the department, the CEQA analysis was required, and we are the lead agency for the purposes of CEQA. As I mentioned, this analysis has already begun, and it's focused on the effect of issuing the permits. We held the scoping meetings last fall, and the DEIRs are getting pretty close to the administrative drafts. So we expect to have public review drafts out by the middle of September. We'll have a 60-day review period. We're hoping to have the final reports and the certification completed by the middle of February, after which we would sign the ITPs and the MOUs. And our goal is to have the programs in place for the 2008 irrigation season, which starts on April 1st. And that's all I have for you today. I'd be happy to entertain your questions.
Any board member comments or questions?
I always do, Mr. Chair. Caitlin, thank you. A couple questions on these watershed-wide permit programs. If an individual landowner wants to opt out, are there provisions for that in the event that they wish to have their own permit?
Absolutely. We have a revocation clause in the incidental take permit, and it spells out the steps that would be necessary to opt out.
So they are. So landowners are aware of that opt-out clause?
Absolutely.
Okay. I understand that you had said under the incidental take permits, when you sent out the letters of intent to the diverters, over 90% were willing to participate?
Not initially.
Were there penalties or disincentives, or how did you
eventually get them to sign up?
Yes.
Well, we conducted a mailing. The original mailing just spelled out what the laws stated and that we were intending to create this program, and we didn't get a very strong response. So we reminded them about their legal responsibilities in several additional letters. And eventually, we actually had, in some cases, members of the community, in some cases, fish and game employees, contact some of these people and say, you know, we really are hoping that you're going to work with us. Is there a reason you're uncomfortable, or did you not get the mailing, or you know what I mean? It did take several mailings, but eventually we got there.
Do you still have landowners that are still not cooperating?
In your opinion? There might be a couple on either side that we didn't get a letter of intent from, but I don't know why.
Okay. On the in the Scott River, when we were talking about the avoidance and minimization obligations of the sub-permittees, you had said that in the Scott River, maintaining connectivity was one issue.
Mm-hmm.
But is that a seasonal thing? How does that impact the landowner in the event that they're unable to maintain that? Or do they need to go in and cut a channel, or what has been your experience?
My experience is that this is a measure that is that will be implemented without a problem.
Okay.
No, I don't think there will be a problem. I want to refer to the language exactly, which says basically, in the event that there's a break of connectivity of French or Lower Shackelford Creeks in Scott River prior to June 15th, then landowners, sub-permittees, will agree to refrain from diverting 25% of their water right for up to 12 hours at a time, more frequently than twice a week.
Okay, so the intent there is to increase flow so that we can keep the connectivity there.
Correct.
The main stem? Okay, and if, in the event that that's not possible, are there stricter guidelines then in place, or because I know once we try and maintain connectivity, if that doesn't work, and they have to cut a channel, would that then be considered a stream bed alteration, or is that not even a?
That is not contemplated.
Okay, on the section 1602 of the Fish and Game Code, you indicated that. The department would have to be notified if there was going to be any substantial changes or use of any materials from the stream beds. Is that information shared with us or with any other agencies once you've been notified?
The Stream Adulteration Agreement program does send something to the regional board when they issue permits, but I am not in that program. I'm not sure what they send.
The reason for my question is just in terms of coordination and keeping communications open. Because there have been concerns when, for instance, Fish and Game may approve something and we may not, and then trying to help coordinate some of that to make it easier for the public. I'm just curious on how that works.
Mr. Chairman, members of the board, my name is Mark Stouffer. I'm a Environmental Program Manager with the Department of Fish and Game. As I understand the way that works now, when we issue the Stream Bed Alteration Agreement, we consistently notify them that, A, it doesn't satisfy any other requirements of law. For example, they may need a permit from the Corps of Engineers, may need authorization from the Regional Water Quality Control Board, and we provide them with the references to make those contacts to be sure that they can comply with those other statutes and authorities. I don't recall, and I don't think that we send copies of every agreement to the Water Board at this time. We simply notify those people that they may have obligations for those other authorities, and they're required to contact them to make sure that they're in compliance with those statutes. And that amount of coordination we're still working on that.
Now, are there certain provisions? What I'm curious about is, let's say that you were to sign off on a particular agreement, and maybe I'm going to use a hypothetical. We put up fencing, or we ask a landowner to put up fencing, and that would help the fish habitat. But in the event that it interferes with other game, like let's say deer, how does that influence your decisions on what we're trying to accomplish as a water board, but at the same time trying to make sure that we're not affecting other animal habitat?
Well, we do have provisions for wildlife-friendly fencing. I'm not sure if that would address your concern.
Let me add a couple things there. One is that the authorities of the Water Board and the authorities of the Department of Fish and Game overlap in terms of interest. We both have an interest in sufficient quantities and quality of water to provide, for example, for aquatic resources, fish. And the the example that you used typically shouldn't be a significant problem to resolve. When we have had instances in the past where we have made recommendations that seemed or were incompatible with recommendations of other agencies. For example, in timber harvesting, we were a review team agency. We might make a recommendation relative to some activity in or near a stream. We participate as a review team agency. We also participate as a permitting agency through the 1602 program. Department of Forestry and Fire Protection has lead agency authority. So we both have authority over a particular project, and some of those same instances would apply with respect to the Water Board. Typically, the regulated public is not shy about identifying those apparent conflicts to us. And I don't know that we have had any impasses that we've breached in those instances. I can't imagine really that fencing would be an example where that would be. And let me go back with respect to your question about coordination, for example, with the Water Board on stream bed notification agreements. We send complete letters to the Regional Water Quality Control Board on all notifications, but that doesn't mean that we necessarily check back to see what the consequences of that communication with the board were.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Do the 90% of the participating diverters have coverage under incidental take at this time?
The letter of intent program is essentially a grace period, saying that while we are working to develop this program, we understand that you do intend to participate in this program. they may change their mind at the end date when the CEQA compliance is complete and we're prepared to implement that program. They may decide at that point in time that we would rather not participate in the program. We would rather obtain our own stream and alteration agreement. We don't like the conditions in the program, the watershed-wide program. We're going to get our own incidental take permit. Or they might say, we don't think we need one, in which case we'll have a different kind of conversation with them. They're not under any legal obligation necessarily to follow through with that program once we're done. We think, though, that we'll have at least a high rate of participation in that based upon the outreach we've done, based upon listening to folks in terms of their concerns, the issues that they have with proposing or trying to comply with the measures that are in that, for example, the master list of terms and conditions. We've had a number of meetings with the public on those terms and conditions, listened to them in terms of their concerns, and in some cases we've made modifications to make them more implementable on the ground. When it comes to next spring and we're complete with the CEQA process, we're going to find out really how well we've done. Folks will sign up for that program or they won't, but one way or another they will have to comply with Fish and Game Code sections.
I'm a bit confused. Is it one program they'd sign up for, and it's a stream bed alteration program? Or?
Well, in this case, we might think of the stream bed alteration agreement program and the incidental take permit programs as companion or parallel programs, and we are integrating that with an environmental impact report in each valley, which covers both of those programs. So really, it's just a distinction without a lot of importance in terms of whether or not one program covers other programs. In other words, we have a watershed-wide program. We're involving our stream bed alteration agreement people, our CEQA folks in the department, and our folks that deal with incidental take permits. And we're trying to accomplish compatible compliance with all of those statutes at one time. So we loosely refer to that overall as a watershed-wide program.
But each diverter would need an incidental take permit, which is a sub-permit under the program, and the stream and alteration agreement.
And each and every one of them would need a stream bed alteration agreement?
Because of the clause regarding substantial diversion in that statute.
And almost all of them will need an incidental take permit as well.
And these permits, you're not giving them away. They have to pay for these permits, I imagine.
Well, the fees have already been paid. That's one of the beauties of the program. And since the department identified funding sources for the CEQA analysis, there will be no fee from the department for the alteration agreements.
So the landowners pay nothing for this?
They would pay the RCD for administering the incidental take permit program. And right now, the department has a contract with RCDs to identify permit fee structure that would be fair and equitable. They've contracted an economist to conduct an analysis so that...
By acreage or...
Yeah, there's a number of different...
percentage of use of water diversion, that sort of thing.
Right.
Now, those diverters and agricultural operators who choose not to participate in this program would still need, however, to comply with the Fish and Game Code section for stream bed alteration agreement with the California Endangered Species Act. And if they elected to do that on their own, there would be fees for the 1600 program. There would be environmental filing fees for California Environmental Quality Act. And they would have to pay for their own CEQA compliance.
So it's structured to incentivize them to work with the RCDs, essentially.
Yes. Maybe subjected to the same regulations and permits, but it's one-stop shopping with the RCD.
Streamlined, anyway.
Yeah.
I just want to reaffirm one other thing. You put in the 10-year for the incidental take permit. It's 5 years for the programmatic stream bed alteration permit.
Correct.
And that's statutory, so that's...
The landowner could ask for a renewal at the end of 5 years for a one-time renewal.
I just had a couple other comments. One, I think I hope both our staff and Fish and Game treat this as a major opportunity to try and reconcile some of the differences on the stream bed alteration permit, and I think we can actually go a long ways along that line. I'm both very excited about the connectivity, but I will throw out one cautionary note. I'm excited because per ounce of water, you're literally pooling your water in your habitat, and you're able to take advantage in seasonal flows and have a little bit of alteration between ag and fish that may be beneficial to both. So I really commend you for putting your foot in the water on it. The way it's specifically written, I have some concerns. One of them is the 12 hours may be so short as to potentially cause stranding. I mean, that may be quite a ramp up and ramp down, and I would assume there would be a lot of sensitivity towards doing that. And I almost view and may think we're better off. I hate taking out specifics, but I almost think we might be better off that we're going to experiment with a couple different regimens and find out what works to do that. So don't treat my comments as critical. I really appreciate your potentially, I think, having a tremendous bang for the buck on protecting fish and one of the least costs for ag. So it's a very exciting program. At the same time, I'm not sure how much we know, and then there's some super site-specific elements that would influence that. And so I would hope we would look at it a little bit more as an information gathering program than as a mandate that's going to protect fish either way.
I'd have to agree with you. And we already have funding available to the RCDs for the contingency plan, where I hope that a number of these issues are drafted out and that we have opportunity to experiment with them and use, you know, our review period as an adaptive management opportunity.
And another way to address that, Mr. Chairman, is that the, as you're familiar, one of the elements has to do with the Water Trust, and it has not yet been implemented, as far as we know, as a procedure in California, although it has been in the Northwest. So that may be, in the instance that you're referring to, maybe yet another tool to address that if it turns out that those numbers at the outset are not exactly the right numbers.
And I also want to compliment you on going and considering the Water Trust, trying that concept in California and really having it out of private money. And while I think for a lot of years it's going to be on the leasing side of the aisle or temporary, it may very well, in combination with some of these other things, really improve things on the ground for everybody. So.
And we really owe that to the forward thinking folks over in the Scott Valley.
Yes?
I had a question, a couple actually. What mechanisms do the department or perhaps the RCD have to enforce or follow up on what's being done, at least for responsible parties below Dwinnell? RTMDL relies a lot on this program, and so the follow-up question is what, and maybe it's to our staff, what mechanisms do we have in place to communicate with each other so that we're able to know what's been done and what's been working and what to do if it's not been done or isn't working?
I guess the first thing I'd say, Samantha, is that we have monitoring at different scales in terms of reporting for implementation compliance. Both there, each of the individual diverters will have some monitoring requirements with respect to providing, for example, in some instances, photo documentation that things were implemented. There's an obligation on the part of the Department of Fish and Game, and in the conditions for the agreements and permits that we're writing, an opportunity for the Department of Fish and Game to access those sites to inspect for compliance as well. The department also will be implementing and will continue their monitoring programs for fish resources in both valleys. So we're going to have an opportunity to look at biological response in terms of the effectiveness of the measures. We have been working on this. We've been working on the recovery planning with the Scott and Shasta Rivers for I'm going to say 5 years, and that's probably in the ballpark, although it's not exact. And looking at strategies to implement the program, which has evolved a lot. We have the program has evolved a lot in the last year, and certainly a lot over the last 2 years. Water Board staff have been more engaged in these two valleys pretty intensively for a few years, but perhaps not quite as long as that. I think both organizations have, and this is in my interpretation here, both organizations have been looking for ways to implement their authorities in pretty creative ways. And while we're busy doing that, we haven't done as much as I hope that we can get to a point and down the road in terms of sharing that kind of information, because we do have the same interests, again, in both quality and quantity of the water industry. So I don't have the answers to that. There's certainly more that needs to be done there, both in terms of not duplicating our resources, creating a situation where one organization says you can only do A and the other organization says you can only do B, and then the landowner's caught in the middle there. I don't have a complete answer in terms of how we get there.
I think we're looking forward to coordinating those efforts, at least downstream in Dwinnell. And then a follow-up question on the master list of terms and conditions. My question is, who decides which ones? We have the same issue in the Shasta TMDL. We cite a number of measures, for example. Is there any mechanism there in the sub-permits to decide which measures, or is that up to the landowner, or how is that being implemented?
It's ultimately up to the department to be sure that we... But that's not to say that there won't be some back-and-forth dialogue. I mean, the landowner obviously is going to express their opinion about it. And ordinarily in the 1602 agreement process, there's a step called arbitration, whereas if the landowner doesn't agree with the conditions that we establish, they can go to an arbitration panel. That option does not exist in these programs. This is a special program. So ultimately, the department will make those decisions as a way of implementing our trustee responsibility. That is not to say that we have not already and won't in the future listen to landowners in terms of suggesting permutations or alternatives to that.
Well, Board Member Anderson had one question, and we'll go to our executive.
At the end of the day, what's the department's definition of success?
The recovery plan does include some of our goals statewide in terms of a recovery of coho salmon. And the Scott Shasta system has essentially a Scott Shasta recovery plan. Incidental take permitting is not the same as recovery. Some of the actions that are in the recovery plan are also the same actions that we're going to use for the streambed alteration agreement, for the incidental take permit, and could also be required through compliance with CEQA, all of which have different goals and objectives and standards for meeting each of those state statutes. The goal of an incidental take permit is to, there are a number of issuance criteria. First of all, to avoid jeopardy. Secondly, to minimize the impacts of taking. And third, to provide full mitigation for any taking that does occur. There are also other issuance criteria that are intended to protect the rights of individual landowners. All of those have to be implemented through a CESA permit. There are different goals associated with Section 16.2 of the Fish and Game Code. And that has to do with providing sufficient protection for fish and wildlife resources. It's our view that at the end of the day, implementation of these permits will achieve full mitigation, which means that, in this case, coho salmon will be at least as well off at the end of the permit period as they were at the beginning. In fact, we believe that they're going to be better off. The agricultural operations in both valleys for many decades have been managed where coho salmon were certainly not the first priority. We're going to be removing barriers up and down both systems in these streams. We're going to be working to provide flows so that fish can move upstream and downstream when they need to at the appropriate life stages. We're going to be trying to provide spawning and rearing habitats so that when spawning is successful, those fish can actually reach a size where they can successfully outmigrate. By doing all of those things, we don't think there's any other reasonable expectation but that coho salmon will be better off at the end of the permit than they are now. And that is consistent with contributing towards recovery. These permits by themselves are not going to achieve recovery for the species, but they will contribute towards that recovery. We do not have specific quantitative goals for exactly how many fish we expect to return and exactly how many fish we expect to go out, in part because successful recovery of anadromous fish depends upon conditions not only in the Shasta systems, but in the Klamath River, for example, and in the ocean conditions. So it's a hard question. You asked a fair question. It's a hard one to answer quantitatively.
I have a question.
Okay, go ahead.
Mr. Chair. When you talk about raising the levels of the coho, bringing them back up toward did you say historical levels? You didn't say historical, but
Somewhere along the recovery curve, there'll be some historical level.
Yeah. Do you know what the historical levels are?
Not with any precision. We do know that in these valleys, generally there's a coho exists in usually three distinct cohorts, which are genetically and reproductively isolated. It's one cohort out of the three in both valleys that is stronger than the other two. Although it's stronger, we wouldn't say that it's it's not a large run. It's probably not approaching what historical levels were a few decades ago. We believe that that run needs to be strengthened, and both of the other runs need to be increased as well.
Is the habitat in critical condition, or you have some existing level of fish in the water?
Yes, we do. And the information we have about even where they, all the places they spawn and rear, is not really sufficient for us to answer that with a great deal of precision. Our fisheries program, managed by Steve Turek, who was up here a little while ago, is conducting both out-migrant information and trapping fish to determine. We've actually done some radio transmitters on returning adult fish to see where they go. Every time we initiate a new study, we learn things that we didn't expect. So I think it's fair to say that what we don't know exceeds what we do know.
Does that include any shocking surveys you've done?
Can you answer that?
Not specifically for collecting data. I think there have been...
For other reasons.
That's correct.
I just had one other sort of subtlety of clarification. You indicated the plan would be consistent with coho recovery. I believe that some of the coho recovery plans are actually in the RCD and the ITP, so that you're actually implementing some of the coho. Not only is it consistent, but you're implementing portions of
the tasks, the specific tasks. That's correct.
That's because a project that benefits coho salmon might be a project you would use through a permit or a non-permit driven regulatory program. The universe. Good things you can do for coho salmon is a long list, but you're going to draw upon that same list whether you're implementing 1600 agreements or ITPs or recovery actions that are not driven by issuance of a permit.
And I realize this is outside the scope of the program, but would you opine with an opinion how much overlap does the same provisions will be beneficial to Chinook and Steelhead as well?
To the extent that the effects of both programs, as well as the TMDLs that the Water Board is implementing, are going to result in colder water, in some instances, more water in parts of the stream. Both of those, so far we're not close to making the water too cold, too clean for salmon yet, whether they're coho salmon or Chinook salmon. So, I would be hard-pressed to really identify what we're doing for coho salmon as being an adverse effect
for Chinook salmon, for removing barriers, for trying to prevent the reduce the amount of warm tail water that goes back in the stream, which would also reduce the amount of nutrients that go back in the stream. Someday we may have enough success with coho salmon that we have to be careful not to do things that are less effective for Chinook. That day is not soon.
Board member Anderson.
Not to put you on the spot, but I respect, Mark, your opinion on things. And recently, your federal counterparts came out with a coho recovery plan. Quick read of it that I gave read like the state's recovery plan. Is that a good thing? And did they get it right?
I haven't. All I know is indirect, and I haven't read the federal recovery plan. I understand that they did rely upon ours to a great deal, and we think they had it right.
Any other board questions? We'll back to the executive director.
Okay. The next in series is from Siskiyou County, Mr. Jim Dupre. I don't know if Ms. Armstrong is going to speak. Oh, and Ms. Barber.
And
to the executive director, should I just call on you? Because I'm not sure. I don't have a speaker's list or anything, so it's a little...
It's actually in your board package under number 8. You don't have the names with them, but you have the next, you have the order of business.
A little obscure, so I will call on you.
Sir.
Why don't you go ahead and proceed?
Okay. Good afternoon. My name is Terry Barber, and I'm the Public Health and Community Development Director. And I just want to give you a very brief update and status report on the progress of the county in updating its land development manual. That manual update is very important to us because it outlines the development standards that will apply to all discretionary projects approved in the county. The manual not only updates county development standards, but it consolidates a variety of state regulations and best management practices into a one comprehensive document that'll be an easy reference for developers in the county. To date, we've held two public workshops on the draft document and solicited comments from agency stakeholders. As a result of that process, or that comment process, we have been working with stakeholders to resolve a couple of issues. Once we're able to resolve those issues, we will be completing the final draft, complying with CEQA, and then seeking the approval of the our Board of Supervisors. And so while I don't have a specific date as to when we anticipate approval of that document, I can say that for a number of reasons, the county is very anxious to update its land development manual and looks forward to that. And that's any other questions about our progress or the document, I'd be happy to answer those.
Good afternoon, members of the board, staff, and members of the public. I'm James Dupre. I'm the Natural Resource Policy Specialist for Siskiyou County, and I'm going to sit in for Scott Sumner, who's the Deputy Director of Public Works, for the roads MOU portion, and then I'll also be giving you the groundwater update. The following update and comments on the roads MOU refers to the county's actions on roads in the TMDL action plan. The first item there is a roads discharge sites inventory. And I'm happy to report that the sediment inventory that we're using, I believe this is with five counties, is 55% complete. It is scheduled for completion in April of 2008. It won't be until that time that we'll have a sense of the size of the problem or the number of sites total. Currently, the number of recommended treatment sites stands at nearly 600. Regarding prioritizing that list of sites, once we get that full list, once we have that inventory done, there'll have to be some discussion and agreement on a process and protocol, most likely using the five county assistance to figure out how to prioritize that particular list. As far as the schedule to fix those sites, obviously that'll depend upon the how many sites that we're able financially to work on per year and the size of the fix for each of those sites. But we intend to have those financial resources or gain those resources, and we'll annually update that list of sites to make sure that we're making progress. Regarding the practices that will be used to fix the sites, we'll likely use the general guidance provided in the Five County Roads Manual for county road maintenance. The manual was recently approved by NOAA Fisheries, and I think we got that approval email on the 24th, so rather timely. But NOAA Fisheries has completed the consultation process for the roads manual and approved manual activities for incidental take for threatened and hazardous species under Limit 10 of Section 4D of the ESA. As those practices are implemented, obviously there's a monitoring component. And monitoring that's yet to be developed, we probably won't develop until we get to the point where we have a fuller understanding of how we're going to fix those sites, but monitoring will cover implementation monitoring and effectiveness monitoring. And finally, regarding the county commitment, the county is committed to do this inventory and fix these sites as resources allow, and we are working to have those and gain those resources. So that completes the roads MOU. I'll take questions, but I have to tell you I'm not an expert on the roads.
Mr. Chair, could I have the gentleman share with the board the situation with the secure rural schools monies and how that impacts Siskiyou County in the event that the federal government does not provide those funds to the county?
Yes, the School and Roads Act, I think we have just a one-year extension on that act. That act originally gave 50% of gross receipts from returns to the public forest lands or public lands, half for roads for the Road Department of Counties and the other half for schools. We have no guarantee that legislation is going to continue. And I believe that it's $4 to $5 million each year for the county budget that act supplies. So obviously that's going to make a big dent in our ability and in the level of resources that we can bring to bear. I understand from Brian McDermott, the Public Works Director, that we'll have some ability through the bonds that were passed to gain some funds to sort of carry us along. But that is a big worry and a big concern of ours.
And the $4 to $5 million is just the roads?
I believe it's $9 million overall for both schools and roads in the county, and $4.5 or $4 to $5 of that is public roads.
And could you share with us what is that in terms of percentage of the total budget for roads and schools?
Boy, I'm sorry, Dr. Rakim, I don't have an answer. Maybe Terry.
Maybe
Supervisor
Armstrong behind
you
might be able to answer that question.
50%.
Any other questions on the roads part? Going to groundwater, we've been requested under the action plan for the Scott River TMDL to obtain some groundwater information for use in completing, I guess you could say, the temperature TMDL on the Scott River. To that point, there's a deadline to develop a study plan for those groundwater studies necessary to develop that information. The county, however, has been looking at groundwater management planning for some years. It is a strategic action plan point coming from the 1999 strategic action plan. So we, in this case, hope to do two things. One, to satisfy the information that you and your staff require, but we also want to develop information that gives us a holistic, an understanding of the aquifer. The idea being that if there are issues or problems to be solved or resolved, that we have enough of an understanding of the aquifer or basin that we know how to design some of those management actions that will do that. For the Scott River TMDL, the deadline is September 8th, and I am happy to inform you that the development of the study plan is on schedule for submittal to the Regional Water Board, you folks, by September 8th. A detailed study plan outline has been done at this point. Field work will be done in August, and the study plan draft circulate. The study plan will need the Siskiyou Resource Conservation District Board approval for submittal. A final study plan will be completed by August 28th and will be submitted to the County Board of Supervisors at their September 4th board meeting for their approval for submittal. The county appreciates the funding facilitated by Brian McFadden and other Regional Water Board and State Water Board staff and provided by the state to help prepare the study plan. The study plan is being prepared by Thomas Harder, Ph.D., who is the UC Cooperative Extension Specialist with the Department of Land, Air, and Water Resources, University of California, Davis. His Ph.D. is in hydrology, with an emphasis on subsurface hydrology and modeling. He is a hydrology specialist. The county is using what it calls a community-based approach to groundwater management planning. The county has jurisdiction over groundwater and will exercise its stewardship responsibility through oversight of the development of study plans, groundwater studies, and groundwater management in the county. It will use a technical team to advise on technical issues. It will use legal entities at the local level in each of the groundwater basins or aquifers as these are developed to administer funds to conduct these studies and to conduct education and outreach to build public support and involvement. For Scott Valley, the Siskiyou RCD and the Scott Valley Watershed Council and its Water Committee will be used. The intent of the groundwater studies is to obtain information both for the TMDL and to understand the hydrology of the Scott Valley Basin. To formalize this approach, the county is preparing a formal countywide policy statement for adoption by the Board of Supervisors. That statement is currently being reviewed by staff. In addition, a draft memorandum of understanding will be developed between the county and the Siskiyou RCD, which has been prepared in draft, and that will outline the roles of the county and the Siskiyou RCD with respect to the Scott Valley Basin. This draft MOU is being reviewed by County Council at this time. And that completes my groundwater review, and I'll take any questions you may have on that.
Do board members have questions? I have one. Aren't you, in addition, coordinating between counties with MODOC or et al. On your groundwater?
We do coordinate with MODOC County for the Upper Klamath Basin, which overlaps.
Now, I realize it's out of this, but in looking at a holistic picture. Okay.
Well, I had thought that actually the initial guinea pig, if you will, would be the Tule Lake area because of the water issues in the upper basin. And it's complicated because you have both MODOC County and Siskiyou County involved with the California side of that aquifer. And then you have the state of Oregon involved on the Oregon side. And they did attempt, Tule Lake Irrigation District did try to attempt to prepare an AB 3030 groundwater management plan. But but ran into difficulties. And a lot of those difficulties had to do with the fact that the irrigation district, the Tule Lake Irrigation District, is not very large and obviously doesn't cover even enough of the aquifer on the California side. So there were some people issues. And I think the lesson there was that we know that we need to build that public support if we're going to be able to develop a way to resolve groundwater issues and manage the water that is not adjudicated, you know, is not managed in, or water mastered under other law in a way that works.
Any other questions, staff?
No. So the next set, thank you, Jim. Thank you, Terry.
Mr. Chair, one quick question, because this has been, and I'm looking at down the list, and I don't see flood control in the Scotta River in particular. We don't have that much of a problem in the Shasta, but most recently, I believe it was a year and a half ago, we had flooding in the Scott Valley. And I'm just curious if the county is taking any measures to look at flood control at this time, and if not, why not?
I'm not aware, I guess, of any measures. I think you're talking about specific measures, like what are we going to do with county roads, or is there an emergency?
Is there a plan to address it? Because I believe it was New Year's Eve of last year, a year and a half ago, where we had some flash flooding through the Scott River Valley. And what can we do to... Because that's a lot of stormwater, obviously.
Let's just say to the TMDL side, I think we've always had concerns that you could put in restoration efforts. You could come up with a plan to accomplish riparian plantings and so forth where you can. Yet we know that there are going to continue to be climatic events that will result in floods of one degree or another. And I don't know that the TMDL, or even in terms of fish restoration, that we've accounted for how to do restoration, given the fact that floods are likely in the future. So that is something that we're going to have to work on as we develop more of the details and as the RCDs work to install some of these. And I think you'll also get an answer to this when the RCDs come to the table as well.
Which I will use then as the segue into, we have speakers lined up for the Scott.
Okay, we also had land development manuals. Is that going to be covered? And
Terry Barber covered that.
Okay, so that's covered already.
Yes.
And then I want to ask one last question. Since all I got are categories, is Supervisor Armstrong then under the public, or did she want to say something for the county? Okay. Okay. With that, then we will call on the Scott River Siskiyou Resource Conservation District.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Bill Crum. I'm pleased to be here before your board today. I'm president of the board of the Siskiyou RCD. I'm also representing the Scott River Watershed Council, which is closely affiliated with the RCD. I assured your staff that I would use less than the time they allocated me, which in 30 years appearing before boards, commissions, councils, legislatures, let me assure you that's the first time I've ever made that statement. To that end, I have some printed materials I would like to perhaps give to your executive officer and ask her to distribute it for you. I don't intend to go through these materials, but perhaps in your ride back or tomorrow on the bus, if you're bored, you can go through these materials. I have an extra copy there for the record if you need it. What I do want to talk about is two major activities, the two major activities that we've been undertaking in Scott Valley is related to water quality and habitat and species issues over the last several years. You've heard something about both of those programs from the county and from the Department of Fish and Game. I don't intend to go back over the ground that they have covered already and just repeat what they said, but I do want to focus on two on the groundwater program and the watershed-wide permitting program, making specific points about each. First of all, to give you some background on the ground that I think is useful to understand how our valley is and the landowners in our valley are approaching this matter, I'll give you a little bit of background. In February 2004, as Fish and Game previously said, the Coho recovery strategy was, I don't know if that was the date of approval, but that's the date of the recovery strategy for the state of California for Coho salmon. Also, shortly thereafter, the first phase of the strategic action plan for the Scott River was finalized by the Scott River Watershed Council. Both of those documents identified, more or less in similar language, the need for better understanding of groundwater in the Scott Valley, and then specifically its relationship with surface water and all of the implications and ramifications that relationship has. It also was at about that time that this issue was being focused on by your staff in the development of the studies that led up to the TMDL plan. So in a sense, the stars seem to be, or the planets seem to be lining up on this issue at about that time. It's an issue that causes a great deal of fear amongst landowners with regards to what the implications might be for them, and therefore it's an issue that has to be treated with a great deal of sensitivity at the community level. In 2005, the Watershed Council, specifically the Water Committee within the Watershed Council, started to focus on this issue specifically, and it was very clear it was time to get some motion going. We needed to get a start on the watershed study, what's now leading to the watershed study that you just heard about from Jim Dupre. And it was identified, we felt we needed to get started, we needed to do something that was significant, but we weren't going to take on the whole project at once. And one of the things that was identified, primarily through some very fine assistance we got from the NRCS watershed team here in Yreka, was that we had very little in the way of historical records with regards to static water level in our valley. Department of Water Resources has had a monitoring program on for over 50 years, but it has only been four or five wells, and they were only monitored twice a year. Some useful information, but nowhere near the kind of comprehensive data that you need in order to establish a real good data set to move forward. This seemed to be a real good area to get started on. It seemed like something that we could handle. It was a necessary component of a broader water study. And so what we did, what the Watershed Council did, is put together a series of community meetings. We had active participation from the county. We had active participation. NRCS led the watershed team, led the technical aspects of it. And most importantly, we contacted a gentleman by the name of Ed Romano from Glenn County, who's the former ag commissioner in Glenn County. He's a farmer there and was one of the driving forces and the leaders of a groundwater monitoring and analysis program that Glenn County instituted some years ago. He attended two of our community meetings and was really able to explain to our landowners the importance of having this information, how it was to their benefit to have decisions made on the basis of good information rather than no information or faulty information. He gave some specific examples in their experience where that was very helpful in getting meaningful resolution to issues. And the result of that was that we came out of those community meetings, we felt very broad support from the community to go forward with this static water monitoring program. We immediately put together a committee to oversee that effort, included landowners, and Jim Dupre from the county, Bill Wagner and Mark Horney from NRCS. We later added the county ag commissioner to that group in an advisory capacity. And based upon some of the work that the NRCS has done, laying out areas where we would want to have wells monitored, we ended up with 32 landowners volunteering to allow their wells to be monitored. So we now have in place, and they're spread throughout the central part of the valley. We're not perfect yet, but we've got pretty good coverage between Fort Jones and Callahan, which is about not quite 25 miles. And we've been monitoring water levels monthly since April of 06. So we're about 16 months into the program. The hydrologists tell us that to get a good database, you probably need 5 or 10 years of data. It'll be interesting to see what results we can glean from that at the end of this year, because coincidentally, the 05-06 water year was a very wet year. The 06-07, as I'm sure you well know, throughout our part of the world, extraordinarily dry year. So we've got 2 years back-to-back here, which are going to make probably yield some interesting results, but we do need 5 or 10 years to really get the database we're looking for. The Dr. Harder, Dr. Thomas Harder, who Jim Dupree referred to as being involved in developing a study plan for the broader water study, is also involved in this study. All of the data is being housed at UC Davis, and when we get enough data to analyze, it will be he and the graduate students that work with him that will be doing the analysis on that material. So we think, in summary, and this is pretty typical the way we try and operate, we start with a well-defined objective. We had strong technical and political support. We had a community organization to execute the program. We got the community involved, and through that process, we overcame some pretty strong initial community opposition, and the program is now in place, and we think it's yielding good data for to be used in the future. That really is a transition into the. I really probably don't need to say an awful lot more about the comprehensive groundwater study program that is contemplated. That was covered very fully by Mr. Dupree, other than to say that we will, once we secure funding, assuming that the study plan is submitted and accepted by both the Siskiyou RCD Board of Directors and the Board of Supervisors in September, and meets the needs of your staff, which I'll be very disappointed if it doesn't, because Mr. McFadden has been very, very involved in this process, not only raising funding for us to do the study, but also actively participating as we move through the various steps. I'm sure we'll end up with a product that meets everyone's needs. We'll need to get that funded. I suspect that's going to be a very, very expensive study, knowing how those studies go. But as soon as we can get that program funded, then we will go back into the same kind of a community outreach effort and community involvement that I just described to take that program forward. Let me stop there and just ask if there's any questions on that before I go on to the other topic.
Do board members have questions?
Just one, in terms of landowners with a voluntary well, are these active wells they're using, or are they?
There are basically three types of wells that are utilized. A domestic well does not have heavy enough drawdown when it's in operation to significantly impact the static water level. So if it's a domestic well that is being monitored, it can be monitored at any time. If there are a number of abandoned ag wells that are being monitored, and again, they're by definition are abandoned, so you have a good solid static water measurement. There are some active ag wells that are monitored, and the RCD staff, we have an RCD staff member that does this monitoring on a monthly basis, and I can't give you the exact times, but I know there is a time that is required that well be out of operation to require sufficient recovery to get a good solid measurement of the static water level, and that is followed on the ones where there are active ag wells that are used.
Any other questions?
Yeah, one more question. Just to follow up. Excuse me. Your monitoring, is it just spot measurements that are made?
It is.
One-time visits?
Once a month, every month, they measure, and yeah.
Yeah, just like a depth of water measurement.
Right.
And then they do the rounds to all the wells.
They do every well.
Would there be benefit or would there be cost effectiveness in instrumenting those with inexpensive data loggers? Or would that improve the resolution of what you need? Or is that going too much?
You know, they have a very sophisticated piece of equipment that they take the measurement with.
Sure.
At this point, I think we had some funding to send an employee around. We didn't have the funding to buy the sophisticated, even if they're straightforward monitoring devices.
Well, yeah, even the it'll add up for 25 wells. So
yeah, right. So you know, that could very well be something that we go to in the future. It's something just. We're also talking about on another subject, but on the in the compliance with water rights, this amount of water diverted that is required under the decrees. All of our water rights are adjudicated, but it's specifically called out in the incidental take permit that Fish and Game discussed earlier. At the current time, any verification goes on is at the Department of Water Resources water master in the field actually verifying. We've talked about the technical and economic feasibility of automating some of those in the future, and I think it appears that, you know, some, at least in some cases for larger diversions, that's probably an economic way to get the job there.
Well, I mean, it sounds like you're light years ahead of the previous data set that you had to begin with, so.
Okay. Good. Thank you. Any other questions? I'm sorry.
Does staff have any?
No.
Mr. Chair. Mr. Math. Do we have an idea how long it's going to take when we get some pretty definitive answer out of these 32 wells?
Well, again, you know, the 32 wells, I've definitely gone beyond my technical expertise already in the hydraulics. It's my understanding that it's primarily going to be information source, a data source that will help drive, or at least be a source of data for the comprehensive groundwater study that hopefully Dr. Harder will be doing. So it'll be a source of information. They looked at the information last year, and about the only things they could say, Mr. Massey, was things like it's very clear that the aquifer. It is not a monolithic aquifer. It reacts very differently in different parts of the valley. Pretty qualitative, but those are the kinds of things we've been able to discern so far.
Thank you.
Any further questions?
Okay. Let me just go on briefly then and talk about the watershed-wide permitting program. I believe we're going to have an opportunity to discuss this in more detail with several of your board members and your staff on Friday, in particular going into a lot more detail with regards to the specific measures that are called for in the program. But I did want to cover just one thing here, and I need to slide up. If I hit your computer, we'll probably go offline. And I hopefully you've got a hard copy of this. This is the statement of objectives that we have. We, the Siskiyou RCD, has with regards to implementing this program. And I want to read it for you, and then I want to go back over it. And it brings Scott Valley farmers and ranchers into compliance with the California Endangered Species Act, specifically for coho salmon, and Fish and Game Code in general, but specifically the issues that we're dealing with the most frequently and where we have the most issues is Section 1600, which includes the stream bed alteration agreement, 5901, which is fish passage, and 5937, which is bypass flows. By implementing key salmon recovery tasks, while maintaining the economic viability of the area's small family-owned farms and ranches. So it's really there's three pieces to that statement. We're going to bring our people into legal compliance. We don't want to ruin, we want them to be able to maintain their economic viability. And the vehicle for getting there is the implementation of key salmon recovery tasks. And as Mr. Stouffer explained earlier, this is not recovery, it's not intended to be recovery, but the important point is that almost, he'd use the word almost, the vast majority of the measures that are called for in this watershed-wide permitting program, both the streambed alteration agreement and the incidental take permit, you'll also find in the California COHO recovery strategy. And I even did a count. It's my count, so I can't lay this off on the department, or I can't say the department has looked at it. But by my calculation, the measures that we're undertaking, if I get to the right page, somewhere. There are 24 tasks called out in the incidental take permit that you can also find in one form or another in the COHO recovery strategy. 24. First and second, the recovery strategy has four levels of priorities. E, D, C, and B. And the highest priority for some reason is E. I never quite figured that out. But of the two top priority items, looking at the two top priorities, there are 24 of those measures that are in the incidental take permit. 16 of those, the ITP, by my assessment, and again, that's my assessment, so I don't want to lay it off on anyone else, it fully meets the requirement in the recovery strategy. It says a measure is to do such and so, we are doing all of that measure. In eight other cases, the requirement in or the recovery strategy is broader than the specific measure that we have in the ITP. So in eight cases, I would say that we are partially meeting those tasks that are called out in the recovery strategy. Again, when we go over this with your staff, and I think I understand several of the board members on Friday, we will go into that in much more detail. We'll actually give you the tie back, the reference back that shows exactly which sections of the recovery strategy we're talking about, so someone can look at that on its own. We have utilized a very similar approach in implementing this program, and we're still in the middle of it, right? I shouldn't say implemented, bringing this program forward. We've had numerous community meetings. We've utilized a formal advisory committee. We've had excellent expert support, and we in the department still have a long way to go. We're still in the middle of the CEQA analysis. As Caitlin said earlier, the DIR isn't due out for another month and a half, so we still have a lot of work to do, but there's a lot of work going on now getting ready to implement this thing next spring with the department and with our Watershed Council and with our RCD employees and volunteers. And with that, I will entertain any other questions you may have.
Thank you for taking the time. We have the Shasta River Resource Conservation District.
Hi, my name is Dave Webb, Shasta Valley RCD. Appreciate the opportunity to talk to you. Wanted to maybe take a slightly different tack and talk about some of the things we've been doing in the past and how they mesh with your TNVL goals and desires and our shared opportunities to work together on that. Shasta Valley RCD has been working on fisheries water quality issues for the last 20 years. I think the best way to get an idea of our commitment to work on these problems in the future is to look at what we've done in the past. Got started back in 1988. Stan Sears, you heard from him this morning, president of the Shasta Valley RCD, was approached by a fish and game who pointed out to him and the other RCD board members that fall Chinook salmon numbers were falling to critically low levels The Shasta River was important, the most important tributary to the Klamath Basin for Fall Chinook. And convince the RCD board members that they should take on the task of trying to find out why. So the RCD initiated the first water quality study we had in the Shasta Valley, looking at what factors might be behind that. Based on that study and the additional information they were getting, they moved on to forming the first watershed group in the Klamath Basin, the Shasta Valley Coordinated Resources Management Planning Group, in 1991. That group formed a partnership with Great Northern Corporation and a local nonprofit organization, and together we were able to begin chasing grant funding for both staff for outreach and education activities, and then also for projects to begin making improvements in fish survival, water quality, while at the same time maintaining the agricultural nature of the Shasta Valley. And that was our sort of concurrent goal: improve survival for fish in the Shasta Valley while retaining agricultural land uses. In 2002, we had managed to grow the program to the point where the RCD was able to take it all up internally. We happily parted company with Great Northern Corporation, very amicable division there. They were glad to see that we had been able to raise ourselves up to the point where we could carry the program themselves. That was ourselves. That was part of their goal in serving the community, was to enable other people to grow to the point where they could carry their own programs, which we then did. Since 2002, the RCD has been handling both the outreach education type portion of it, the management of the grants, the application for the grants, all the financial aspects of it, everything involved with much of the restoration work that's been going on. We have also partnered with numerous persons in the private sector to help them also pursue things on their own, both ranchers chasing their own grant funds and contractors who want to. So, since 1988, as you can see, over $11 million in total project-related funds. Many of them related directly to water quality. We'll touch on them in a minute. Others perhaps not so closely related, but are, in our minds, important in the overall health of the community, health of the resources in the community. And the other aspect of this is, well, getting a lot of money is important. You also have to have a way to spend that money. And that means a lot of people on the ground willing to participate in those improvement measures to allow them to occur on their property. So equally important, but not so easily recognized, is the fact that behind that $11 million is a lot of willingness on the part of landowners to work with us to address critical social needs for fish and water quality. So, got started on some of the easy ones: stream bank protection through riparian fencing. Roughly $1,770,000 that we're aware of spent today working on that. Obviously, it's direct one-on-one correlation with the TMDL requirement to protect the stream banks, increase shade. Also, in a more holistic fashion, we want to see increased leaf drop in the stream, part of the fish food chain, more wooded debris, better cover, things like that. And while that may not be a specific TMDL requirement, certainly they're both driven by the desire to protect cold water fish, and that's a critical portion of it. Also want to decrease fine sediment delivery to the stream, which we see as a problem, even though it may not have reached the level that can be dealt with by you specifically through a TMDL. We've also been working on water use efficiency studies, primarily with the irrigation districts. Big Springs Irrigation District, Shasta Water Association, Grenada Irrigation District, and that was done by the Nature Conservancy. And the NRCS did one for the users of one of the flashboard dams we're working on. The goal here was to help the water users understand just how much water they were taking was not being put to a particularly useful purpose, and that in turn would help us to work with them to begin looking at ways to reduce both water withdrawals and the creation of irrigation tailwater, which is what happens to most of that excess water that is not being used efficiently. So we currently have in hand funding for the Consolidated Grants Program, money that will allow us to continue to proceed with irrigation tailwater reduction efforts. To this point, we've had over $670,000 directed towards that. We now have an additional $750,000, which we'll be using to work on that. We're going to be installing a couple of demonstration projects along with a watershed-wide plan, which will allow us to rank and then install some additional smaller on-farm projects to reduce the generation of irrigation tailwater. And we'll be working on one very irrigation district-specific tailwater plan with the Shasta Water Association, which will allow us to build on other work they're already doing to improve their water use efficiency, which will take it down to the lowest level, to the on-farm level. And we should see a substantial improvement as a result of some of this work and the future work that will come of it in reducing the return of hot, nutrient-laden water to the Shasta River, which we think will have a substantial benefit to water temperatures and to the levels of dissolved oxygen. We have also been working, as was previously mentioned, on removal of several impoundments in the Shasta River. Those two that are currently being actively addressed, the Arusha Dam, which is roughly at River Mile 12, built in 1856, and providing water for irrigation for a long, long time. We've been working with the ranchers there to replace it with a pumped diversion, which means where they used to have free gravity water, they're now going to be paying for pumping costs. They also happen to be inheriting the most downstream irrigation diversion pond. They inherit the worst quality water, and as a result, we have the worst quality water right there at that point in terms of overall dissolved oxygen levels and high water temperatures. So we hope to start working on that one this summer in terms of actual construction work. We are somewhat short on funding. In doing these, we try to take a sort of a systems approach that wherein we would address both the in-stream portion, the water quality, but also the water use efficiency. And so we are both removing the impoundment. We are also replacing their open leaky ditch with pipelines, and then we would expect to follow up with them with on-farm measures once we've got that infrastructure in place and they have the further incentive of pumping costs to move them to other on-farm measures that will allow them to reduce their water needs. This one right now is hung up. We very much could use some help, if any help can be had from you, in hustling along an agreement with Prop 50 between Humboldt County and the State Water Board, which will provide us with a portion of the funding we need. And until we've got that agreement in place and then our sub-agreement with Humboldt County in place, we're kind of dead in the water. And if we cannot get that resolved soon, we're going to miss the construction window for this summer. Salmon will be returning to the river, water will come up, and we'll have to postpone construction for another summer. We really don't want to do that. So if there's anything you can do to speed that process along of developing the final agreement between Humboldt County and State Water Board for the Prop 50 funds, it would be really appreciated.
Is the hang-up with the state or with the county? Who's working on it for Humboldt County?
Humboldt County and the state are both working on it concurrently, and they have to reach agreement on. And so I can't say there's any one party at fault, but it from our purposes, it absolutely has to be kept on the top of the pile, or we will not be able to work on that project.
What's the name for each organization that's involved?
Amy Hansen, one of my co-workers, has been carrying this project.
And the name for the organ?
Well, Humboldt County, who's working on farm, or what supervisor? Or?
Kirk Gerard is the lead, I think, for economic development in Humboldt County. And then we've been working with Jeffrey Albrecht from the State Water Board as the project manager there. And so I know they're both working very diligently on this, but we're seeing our construction window close rapidly this summer, and we're getting very nervous.
All right, thank you.
Yeah.
And then with the Shasta Water Association, we had also hoped to start construction this summer. As it happened, bids on the project came in too high. We had some other issues, and so it looks like that one is very definitely going to be postponed till next summer. On that one, too, we are not fully funded. In fact, for the entire project, both the in-stream and then the major distribution system improvements, we're about $2.5 million short. Regardless of that, we probably have to proceed with at least the in-stream work next summer. Some of our money is state general fund money provided through the Department of Fish and Game. It absolutely has to be spent within 2 years. This is the first year, so it will be spent next year. But we are concerned that we will wind up not able to secure the additional monies needed to do the major distribution system improvements, which in turn will create the infrastructure that will allow us to then go down to the on-farm level and address that most effectively. So we're still looking for additional funds on that project. We initiated groundwater investigations with the Department of Water Resources back about in 2003. And our desire there was to try to get ahead of the curve, recognizing that in most areas that we don't start looking at groundwater until after it's a little too late. And you're then trying to play catch-up when the demands are already in place and there's really not much you can do. So we recognize that surface water and groundwater in Shasta Valley are closely interrelated, and in particular, the supply of cold water, which is the only reason why the Shasta River is able to supply cold water fish, is coming from the discharge of groundwater, and that it is very poorly understood in the Shasta Valley. We were fortunate. DWR has been monitoring wells here, some of them since the 1950s. And they have a network of roughly 23 wells they've been monitoring. We also have well logs for thousands of wells drilled for both domestic and irrigation purposes, and some geologic background, all of which we thought needed to be brought together into one place and fully understood before we could then determine what proper next step should be to fully understand the interrelationships between groundwater and surface water. So we've got a lot of good data. We put together a project with DWR as our primary partner. Initially, we didn't expect to be able to get very far, but we really didn't know how much information was out there. We were able to garner about $40,000 in grant funds. DWR came up with about $70,000 in matching time. We dove into it and discovered there was a whole lot more we could do than we thought. By the time we were done, DDR had probably given us 3 to 4 times as much work as they had promised. Unfortunately, it took about twice as long as expected, but nevertheless, it was worth it. It moved us far down the road. We have just received our internal draft final report from them. We will now shortly be getting a commented on final report, and we'll be now putting into place our local advisory team, which will then take that report, digest it, and we'll begin working on next steps. So see that as a great step forward, and perhaps one of the things to recognize that in the Shasta Valley, one of the things that makes it so difficult to deal with groundwater issues is that where other places you have valleys formed by alluvial action, streams washing down alluvial materials from the hills, putting it in layers on the valley bottoms, layer upon layer upon layer, and once you understand those layers, you can pretty well predict what's going to happen and where. In the Shasta Valley, that's not the case. The surface topography of the Shasta Valley, if you look at it when we're out there tomorrow, is the largest volcanic lahar or debris flow on the planet. It was formed about 380,000 years ago, and it is one giant flow of mud and sand and gravel and debris that came down the mountain all at one time and filled the entire Shasta Valley with slurry, more or less the consistency of very wet concrete. Whatever was down there below that was disrupted and is largely lost and is not evident from anything on the surface. Where water flows, how water flows, and how much water flows is very, very difficult to predict in many cases. And so we knew that we had to do some homework before we'd be able to truly predict where various discrete aquifers could be found, how they were interrelated to surface flows in the Shasta River, and how they are also related to the surface application of groundwater, or surface application of water for irrigation, which in turn may be supplementing the groundwater that we're seeing. So we're well along with that, and we will be shortly coming up with next steps, but it is of critical importance to anything we do that might be aimed at either bolstering surface flows by converting surface diversions to groundwater diversions, or protecting stream temperatures by making sure we don't undermine the groundwater levels that are providing for the spring flows that are currently feeding the Shasta Stream. And proceeding too quickly or too blindly with either of those may yield unexpected results, and we don't want to do that. So what we've found over the years is that moving things ahead requires people on the ground doing the education, doing the outreach, doing the arm twisting, doing the everything it takes to keep a program going. It looks to us like moving ahead full bore, meeting the timeline identified in your action plan, really wants two people pretty much dedicated to staying with this. And as you've heard, there's going to be a lot of overlap on ITP issues. That's not surprising. They're both addressing cold water fish needs by and large. But without the ability to keep people out there on the ground, we really can't expect to continue at the rate we have. And as an example of, you know, sometimes people think that because we have a great deal of money coming in from various projects, and as you can see here, we've got $4 million in grants coming in 2006-2007. We have a staff that is very, very good at chasing funds to do projects. But not all those funds include money that will cover administration. None of those projects include money that will cover the ongoing outreach and preparation work for the projects to come next. And we can't stop with where we're at because we all know it's not good enough. We've got to go on to next. And right now, we don't have sufficient money in the pipeline to let us do both. So we really do need help securing funding on pretty much an ongoing basis to keep people working on these critical issues. And right now, we truly do not have enough. So what we envision doing over the next 5 years or so before the next full review comes in, if we're able to find sufficient funding, we need to be working one-on-one with landowners, helping them fully understand what's expected of them, and helping them to meet those needs. We plan to, expect to, we want to be working on flow issues, which also relates directly to temperature, on water trust, dry year plans, and planning for increasing cold water flows, which, again, takes time and is not easy and is potentially directly in conflict with other existing uses, which we somehow have to resolve. We plan to be working on TMDL attainments through the Shasta Water Trust, which we are started on. In 2002, we began looking on the legal aspects of dedication of water in-stream flows and how that could be meshed with the existing Shasta River adjudication and other aspects of water law. That was step one on whatever may be done to dedicate water to in-stream flows to meet the 45 CFS target, which the modeling at least says we need to do. We want to continue on that. We need to continue on that. We sent one of our staff up to the a Columbia Basin Water Transactions Program last year, gather information, make contacts, start on seeing what other people have been able to do elsewhere, make sure that we don't duplicate their mistakes, and try to learn from what they've learned. We are now ready to move towards final planning and implementation, but again, funding. Monitoring. Not worth doing if you aren't tracking how effective it was. Funding for monitoring is frequently hard to get. Everybody wants to move forward. Everybody wants to see projects. Nobody really wants to spend the time to track how effective those projects were. We need to do it. TMDL assistance, meetings like this with you guys, meetings with landowners, can't do it without both. And then brainstorming ways to mesh our shared goals to improve water quality, fish survival, and the needs of landowners to continue to be economically viable and effective. Started back in the early 80s, we had a very few projects, two or three a year. As we went along, in 1992, Klamath River Basin Task Force provided funding for the first actual staff to help with this stuff. 1992, we went to, looks like, about 6 or 8 projects. In 93, about 10. 94, about 10 more. 95, about 10 more. 96, the same. 97. 98, 99, we started ramping up a little more. Got a little bit of money for staff in 2000, 2001. These are all individual funded projects run through the Shasta Valley RCD down here in the Shasta River. You can see that it's going on. There's quite a bit, quite a few. Pretty much dependent upon if we've got the staff, the outreach, we've got the skills, we've got people on the ground that are willing to work with us. We've got to have it all. We've got to have the money that lets us keep working and targets that can be attained. And we will be planning to work with you on meeting TMDLs, on further understanding the nature of the river and what is possible and what's not. And it's going to be a challenge. Don't want to minimize the challenge we're faced with. Don't want to minimize the timeline that you've set. It will be very, very difficult to do. But we're up for it and we want to do it. Questions?
Any board members have questions? Staff? Samantha? You're dead, so.
Okay, speak up.
My question is, what, if any, outreach has the RCD had upstream of Dwinnell? And a correlated question is, in developing the fees for the watershed-wide permitting effort, will that help the RCD in any way for downstream of Dwinnell?
Okay, upstream of Dwinnell. Key feature here is that past funding for essentially all of our outreach has come from entities and organizations interested in salmon. And since Dwinnell Dam is a permanent barrier to salmon, it has not been a high priority to us. We have had to focus our time and our efforts on where salmon can currently reach and efforts that will immediately benefit salmon in order to meet the requirements of their grant funds. So we have done very little outreach, very little education, and very little awareness of much of this above going now. We do have some past fencing projects out there along the stream. We've got a fish barrier removal project that we're going to be part of in a year or so, we expect, above Dwinnell. But there is a whole lot yet to be done up there to bring them fully on board with the TMDL process. They really know very little about this, and you don't see many of them here in the room. And the second half of your question?
That dealt with the fees for that you're negotiating right now for implementing the watershed-wide permit.
Okay, the watershed-wide program for the ITP, again, is largely focused below Dwinnell Dam, where salmon currently have access to, where flows are coming from that are directly affecting coho salmon. So, number one, at the present time, Department of Fish and Game does not envision a need for incidental take permit coverage for persons above Dwinnell Dam. So they're unlikely to be contributing anything to those fees. We are unlikely, as a result, to be able to invest much time from that on other issues up there. Secondly, people below Dwinnell who will have to contribute those fees are probably going to raise issues if they see us taking their money and using it to meet needs other than those directly related to their water uses, their land use practices. So we are not anticipating using the incidental take permit fee process as a way to supplement our general budget. I don't think that would be appropriate use of their money, and I don't think it's yet. So if we are going to do work above Dwinnell, we will have to identify other sources of funds to allow them. And it is well within our district, more than you can guess. And we would like to, but again, funds available is what currently limits us.
Okay, board members.
Mr. Chairman, you have a very impressive record of what you've done for 20 years, and you've got a huge plate full of things you're currently doing. But if you fast forward 20 years, what's your definition of success?
We will still have open space in the Shasta Valley. We'll still have a viable agricultural community that gives us a a conservative in the classic sense base, people who are there year in and year out over decades, who know their community, who are a strong base in their community. We'll have a river that is once again contributing to a strong fishery, hopefully locally, something we lost a long, long time ago, and also to people downstream who depend upon it, both culturally and economically. Water quality that doesn't leave people reluctant that their kids go swimming in the river. And a community that's gotten stronger from working together to resolve problems, not been torn apart by it. It's going to be a challenge to do that.
Okay, any further questions? I'm going to make some very brief announcements. We're going to take a 10-minute break. First, I want to introduce Victoria Whitney, who's the Division Chief of Water Rights for the State Water Resources Control Board. And we also have Supervisor Cook as well as Supervisor Armstrong in the audience. And unfortunately, she stepped out, but we have Sari Summerstrom, who was formerly from this board, and I'm trying to introduce her if she's back in the room. With that, we're going to take a 10-minute recess.
You said design and layout?
Just tell me how to fix your computer.
No, I'm working on taking a class.
Oh,
so
wonderful.
First time we need to put in the email system. Give me my little finger and my little card.
You need to go ahead and submit that too. When you get back.
Okay, we want to reopen the meeting. We have a very quick award presentation that we want to give out. And we're going to start off with that before we take additional testimony. Is Don Meamber in the audience? Can you please step up here, sir?
Come all the way up.
You need the mic.
And we'll have to share the mic here. But I wanted to make a award from the North Coast Regional Water Quality Control Board to you. And this is in recognition of over 15 years of innovation and improvement practices, steady progress, and exemplary leadership for the enhancement of water quality within his own ranching operations, amongst his ranching neighbors, and the entire community of Montague. And so you just have an outstanding record, and we just want to personally thank you and give you this plaque of appreciation.
Well, this was unexpected. I certainly didn't expect this, and it's coming out of left field. Really don't have much to say except I like streams and I like to see them look nice, and I've been slowly kind of getting drug into this from my good friend Dave Webb. seems like years ago.
It was.
But I guess my real beginning was when I got involved with the City of Montague with their wastewater. I'd been using it for irrigation for 30 years, and that's my beginning in this endeavor of keeping the stream clean, and then it was kind of a break in there for a long time until Dave kind of got me interested in actually protecting and restoration on the stream, and I've slowly gotten drawn into with the CRIMP and the RCD, and now I'm the chairman on the committee, and enjoying it, but it's kind of overwhelming with all the regulations from all the agencies. We do what we can do, and I appreciate the North Coast Board and the Municipal, and it's really terrific. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And I thought I would introduce Sari Sundstrom. She is in the room this time, a former member of the North Coast Regional Water Quality Control Board. So thank you for attending. With that, we will call for the Dwinelle Dam Release Study in the Montague Water District.
Lisa Ferris, and I work for the Montague Water Conservation District. And the presentation is on the TMDL Lake Chestina study. The Montague Water Conservation District is a special district overseen by an elected 5-member board of directors comprised of landowners. The daily operations are managed by the district manager. Along with the manager, the district has 2 full-time employees and 1 part-time clerk. The district has tried to be proactive by having a representative at all the meetings, such as the TMDL, the ITPs, etc. But there have been a few meetings that the district was unable to attend. The district has tried to keep the landowners informed through newsletters and a landowner letter that is sent in late March and early April before the irrigation season. In 2006, the directors decided to set up a contingency fund and added a dollar acre per foot sold to the rate being charged. The fund, as explained in the letter to the landowners, was due to the technical nature involved with the TMDLs and the ITPs, etc., and would be used to hire someone to represent the district at meetings that the directors were unable to attend, pay for a consultant, and or hire an attorney. The 2006 fund was $16,880 at the end of the season. The district hired Gary Black as a consultant in April 2006 after the Water Board staff presentation at our meeting. Mr. Black suggested getting started with a monitoring program, and the directors approved purchasing 2 monitors in November 2006 for the TMDL study. Mr. Black suggested checking with Water Board staff as to which monitors would be accepted, and later received a response from a technician who referred him to the SWAMP program. We are developing the scope of work program now with Mike Diaz and Rob Donlin. Now to the plan objectives. We plan to organize a willing working group of responsible parties and seek funding. We want to develop a plan to investigate impairments identified in the TMDL. Develop a plan to cooperate with involved parties to monitor conditions not identified in the TMDL but are important to the community. Implement the monitoring plan for the duration recommended by our consultants. And consultants will review the data and recommend actions to curtail and or correct impairments if it's needed. We've held 2 meetings. The first meeting was just with the parties directly affected by Lake Chestina. There were representatives from the district, county, and Lake Chestina community. The study was to be discussed, but the discussion was mainly about the PACE petition. For the second meeting, the district sent out letters to responsible parties that were listed in an email from David Leland. Again, we had representatives from the district, the county, and Lake Chestina community, as well as the public works directors from the cities of Wheat and Montague and Caltrans. There was an agenda for the meeting and an outline of what the study might involve. The tour route for your tour tomorrow was discussed, but once again, the major focus was on the petition. We were able to learn, though, from the meeting that the City of Weed is currently conducting a runoff study and Lake Chestina is completed a runoff study that just needs to be written up. The Montague Water Conservation District is in the process of a feasibility study with grant money from Fish and Game and the Klamath River Restoration Grant Fund. This study is to assist the Montague Water Conservation District into compliance with current regulations and prepare plans to improve conditions for Chinook, coho salmon, and steelhead trout in the Shasta River watershed. The project will assess the conditions affected and operations conducted by Montague Water Conservation District. The main objective is to investigate existing conditions and propose improvements that enhance aquatic habitat, address compliance issues, and eliminate or reduce impacts to migrating fish of the Shasta River watershed. In short, it will explore the water budget and provide for fish screens. The Weed City Urban Runoff Study is to be completed by March 2008. The Department of Water Resources has conducted many studies, and they have set up monitors on the Parks Creek Diversion, Shasta River near Edgewood, and on the dam, which are all online. The Lake Chestina runoff study should be useful information for the study. The county has offered to work up a memorandum of understanding for the study group, and they have their own studies that may prove helpful. Miguel from Caltrans also offered to share any studies that Caltrans may have done that would be related to water quality in Lake Chestina. This is a study outline that I worked up from the suggestions listed in the Chestina Limnology Study by Michael Diaz. The inflows, outflows, and operations should be covered with the Fish and Game Feasibility Grant that goes until spring 2009. Bathymetry of the lake, the Department of Water Resources probably has the information on the volume and area of the lake. Weather conditions. Monitors will be set up by the lake to measure precipitation, temperature, wind speed and direction, and atmospheric pressure. Water quality will be addressed at the inlet, middle of the lake, and outlet. And we hope that the County Health Department will continue to monitor the lake for health concerns. Urban runoff studies from the City of Weed and communities of Lake Chestina and Edgewood would be useful information. Even though temperature was not a factor for the district in the TMDL action plan, the district plans to gather this information from monitors on the outlet in the areas that leak. I think it's important to look at all the beneficial uses in the entire watershed and not just the cold water dependent species. Montague Water Conservation District is hoping to find a balance with the competing beneficial uses, and that is why we are playing such an active role. Part of the study will be to review past data and gather new information. The TMDL cited a study of the district that was done in 1959. Many new developments and practices have been put into operation since 1959. The district has encouraged landowners in the district to seek funding from the NRCS and the Shasta River RCD for pipelines, sprinkler systems, and tailwater return systems, which you'll be able to see tomorrow on your tour. The district has not been eligible for the funding as a district, but we have worked with landowners by supplying the labor and equipment to keep costs down for the landowner, which helps the district become more efficient. The district has an ongoing plan to gunite parts of their system to cut down on ditch loss, especially through the lava area in Big Springs. And this gunite program started in 1947. The last gunite project was about 3/4 of a mile of ditch that was gunited in 2002. The gunite projects are usually done during the drought years since there's a bigger window of opportunity to start and complete the work from the end of the water season to the beginning of winter. Manager Crable's next project was to line the 10-foot wide and 1,800-foot long flume with a rubber lining in 2003. This project eliminated all the leaks, which cut down on the maintenance around the flume. The district decided to experiment more with the rubber lining and lined a mile of ditch in 2004. The cost to line a mile of ditch was the same as a half mile of gunite, and the rubber lining took less time and labor to complete. However, the main drawback has been that vandals are constantly cutting up the lining, and the upkeep has been costly and time-consuming. In 2005, the district worked with landowners on the west side of Three Mile Lane to install a pipeline. The pipeline was financed with landowner grant money and district labor and equipment. The pipeline has cut down on ditch maintenance, and deliveries have been more efficient. This pipeline was
going to Mr. Miamber's place. And it helped like think about 8 or 10 deliveries all the way down. It made it more efficient. Then the system now runs into two ponds that were made to help capture and use district water and to keep the tailwater from entering the Shasta River. The ponds and pipelines to the ponds were made possible by the landowner, a grant, and the district labor and equipment. As you can see, the district has been improving the system. Now the project for the next couple of years is going to be the TMDL study. Any questions?
Do any board members have any questions?
Mr. Chair, why are vandals cutting up the rubber?
I don't know. They cut a great big square out of it, and we have a hunch that it might be that they think that they're getting less water, you know, for their wells or something. I think they think it's affecting groundwater or something. I don't know.
All right. Any other questions or comments of board members? Well, thank you. We appreciate your presentation. And are we going to have another presentation on Lake Shasta, or is that covered in this? That was covered in, okay. So the next item is dedicated cold water, David Leland. And David, I hate to do this. If you can keep it around 5 minutes instead of 10 minutes, it'd be appreciated.
Do my best.
Afternoon. Mr. Chairman, members of the board, David Leland, Division Chief of the Watershed Protection Division. I'm going to talk about some ideas for addressing the in-stream flow issue that was included in the TMDL action plan. I'll try to be brief, and I can be brief because I'm discovering that my talk is somewhat out of date even before I've had a chance to give it, based on the presentations that both Lisa and Dave Webb just gave with respect to the many activities that are already going on in the Shasta. The action plan calls for diverters to employ practices that would result in increased dedicated cold water in-stream flow in the Shasta and its tribs, with a goal of increasing dedicated cold water flows by 45 CFS or an alternative flow regime that achieves the same temperature reduction. So the TMDL is based on temperature. Flow is a piece of that, as Matt St. John explained a little bit earlier this afternoon. Shasta River watershed ownership is relevant here. The uplands are largely in federal hands with some private timber, but the central part of the valley where the irrigated lands and farming lands are primarily in private ownership. There are a number of large irrigation districts. These are depicted here. Montague Irrigation District is here, which derives its water from Lake Shasta, travels by ditch down there. Big Springs Irrigation District, Grenada, Shasta Valley water users, and other individual users also in that area. There are a variety of management strategies that could be applied to improve water operations in the Shasta Valley and other places where irrigation is part of the land use part of land use. I've selected about 8 of these from the 2005 Department of Water Resources water plan update that look like they're especially applicable or are already being used in the Shasta Valley. And I'll talk about a few of these in the next few slides briefly. Water use efficiency has the potential to substantially increase production per unit of applied water, which results in water savings. There are both hardware, infrastructure, and water management techniques that can be used on that. Dave Webb spoke of a number of these. System reoperation. Some of these you are probably familiar with. Lake Shasta, for example, has a very important temperature control device for releasing cold water from behind Shasta Dam into the Sacramento River. Risk management may be a little bit obscure, but the dry year contingency plan that was mentioned a little bit earlier today would be an example of that. Changes in points of diversion. We haven't heard talk of that specifically today, but that is under consideration by the Grenada Irrigation District, which has recently completed a study of how to improve their operations. Ag land stewardship. We've talked about, many people have talked about tailwater recycling and reuse. Crop shifting or crop idling would also be opportunities. And economic incentives. We've talked about grants, subsidies, rebates, rate structures, water purchase, all are other examples of that. And the key to all of this, though, is to put together the water that is gained from all of these other activities into something that is then dedicated to the stream. Any activity that involves a change in the point of diversion or place of use or the purpose of use or a variety of other factors like that, whether it's temporary or long-term, requires some, needs to be addressed through the associated water rights, and that can be very challenging. There are legal mechanisms in place to be able to do that, but there are also, as Vicki described them, Vicki Whitney described it to me earlier, institutional challenges in being able to make that happen. So that seems to be the key rub here. The number of activities that Dave Webb described will have water quality benefits in reducing tailwater and doing a variety of other things. We're looking in the in-stream flow to get a double benefit out of all of that work by also finding ways to dedicate that to in-stream flow. That's where the challenge seems to lie. There are opportunities here, though, and one of the issues that had come up in discussing this a year ago at the adoption hearing for the Shasta had to do with the impression that only a few water users would be affected by this. And in order to kind of think my way through this a little bit, the TMDL had identified opportunities in the Big Springs area in particular for as a source of a lot of cold water. We, through the development of the action plan, included language in there relative to alternative flow regimes. An opportunity exists here, for example, because the Montague Ditch runs right by the Big Springs District, some infrastructure improvements here would allow any water savings that could be dedicated throughout the Montague Service District to be used to replace or supplement water use in Big Springs and then free up that water in Big Springs for dedicated flow. That's just one example that I've identified. I'm sure there are many others. We haven't gotten into the detail of where all of the opportunities lie, and I'll come back to that in a moment. So are these just pie-in-the-sky ideas, or are they real? Here are the eight classes of opportunities that I pulled out of the DWR report. All of these are being done somewhere in California. Most of them are being done in the Scott and the Shasta, and the ones that aren't look like they have the opportunity to be applicable. So I see plenty of tools in the toolbox. I see solutions that don't require reopening adjudications, and I see that all irrigators have the potential to contribute. And as this is where my list is especially out of date. The tailwater recovery grant project that the state board is being funded through Prop 50 is one current action. Grenada Irrigation District study that was recently completed. Dave Webb mentioned a number of others that all relate to the issue of water use. The Nature Conservancy is also looking at this issue on their property on the Nelson Ranch, just below Big Springs. And that concludes what I have to say. Any questions?
Thank you. Board members, questions?
Is there any thought about possible adding additional water storage, especially in light of the fact that we may be dealing with climate change, especially in this particular watershed?
Dr. O'Keefe, I'm going to answer that in a very general way. What we're missing right now, and being able to answer that specific question that you have, is a champion here in the Valley to work with us and with the Division of Water Rights and with Department of Water Resources to be able to go through and evaluate all of the opportunities and where those opportunities lie and what could be successful. I think that off-stream storage is something that I did mention earlier, and there certainly are advantages to that in terms of being able to remove fish passage barriers or allow stream flows and summer stream flows. But there are challenges through the water rights process to be able to actually accomplish that.
Okay, any other questions?
I have one question. With the action plan under the goal, I know you're going through this very quickly. You state that the goal is to increase the dedicated cold water in the Shasta by 45 CFS. And is that, maybe just a little more elaboration, is that 45 CFS, how is that allocation? Is that on a daily basis or to the daily average hydrograph or to
Yes, the idea was it would be to the two existing flows. The analysis was based on a couple of weeks period that the model was applied to. So it's difficult to say exactly what that would mean on any given day in any given year. But the overall intent was to increase above. Well, it's to create actually a dedicated entry flow, which there is not now, to the best of my understanding.
Mr. Anderson.
Do we have an accounting system in mind for, if I bring you five, we have 40 left, or how do we know?
Well, that would be part of the implementation of this through the water rights process would provide that mechanism for the accounting. Because the dedication implies that there's some water rights action that happens in conjunction with that.
And what kind of coordination do we have with BLM, Forest Service, on the federal lands? Because that's a significant amount of property that we're dealing with in this watershed.
I'm not aware that they have any water rights that would come into play on this particular issue.
I believe we have Mr. Clamp's going to be making a presentation for the Forest Service and BLM next.
Yes, and that'll address the Forest Service actions of in a more general way. Yes.
Okay. Any other questions or comments, Seth? I just had one, and it maybe ought to go as well to Victoria Whitney. I had heard that there's quite a backlog on in-stream flow applications, and it's a fairly time-consuming and costly process, and we'd have to factor in perhaps slower deadlines if we go that route. Do either of you have a perspective on that?
Can I answer that?
Yes.
I think I can count the number of in-stream flow applications we have on one hand.
I can't get on mic.
We have a
ma'am?
Yeah. Sorry.
Victoria Whitney, Deputy Director of the State Water Board for Water Rights.
Yeah.
I think we have a relatively low number of in-stream flow applications. That's not really the problem. We have a fairly significant backlog of regular applications, and the same staff work on both of those. But one of my jobs as the Deputy Director of Water Rights is to set water right priorities, and that is not an insurmountable issue.
All right. Well, thank you. That's a very good clarification. Any other comments or questions? Okay, the next presentation then would be Bob Clamp. And, Bob, you're on board for 5 minutes. I had to cut up a tri-four for four.
Four?
And if you argue, you've already lost one.
Wow. For the record, Bob Clamp, Chief of the Timber Harvest Division.
So U.S. Forest Service and BLM, you got to kind of switch gears from water to land, temperature and, you know, sediment, erosion control kind of stuff. We've been talking to the Forest Service quite a bit over the last couple of years, and in fact we met with them yesterday and talked some more specifics about developing these MOUs. We do have a contact for BLM now, and we'll initiate contact with them and then bring them all together. The way we're looking at this is BLM and the Klamath National Forest for the Scott River, and then the Shasta Trinity in the lead for Forest Service in the Shasta River Basin. They have more land ownership there, along with BLM again. Just briefly, we're looking at a model similar to what we're developing on the Salmon River TMDL in that MOU, basically starting with the agency's existing activities and actions. They have a number of management plans. They have a number of ologists, I'll call them, hydrologists, biologists, fisheries folks, a lot of experts available and are able to do some really good work in terms of planning and managing. So we'll take their existing efforts and management plans, take a look at those, take a look at the needs with regard to the TMDL, and then discuss what in addition might be needed. Along with that, we need to understand how they prioritize their work. And part of the process in the MOU will be how understanding how priorities are set, but also how is it that we might be able to influence those priorities through the TMDL. That's probably going to be kind of a sticky wicket, but we're certainly ready to take that on and work with those folks on that. Types of activities obviously will be aimed directly at the TMDL needs. For instance, in the Scott riparian and sediment control activities, sediment inventory on roads, looking at the various erosion control practices and their effectiveness, and the Forest Services have a very good monitoring program with regard to that. Looking at the use of riparian reserves to assist in maintaining cool water temperatures and perhaps planting riparian areas to improve other areas that may need that. And then also looking at grazing management plans and the various activities in that regard. I wrap up with the timetable for the MOU on the Scott is September of 2008 and in January of 2009 for Shasta. So coming up within the next year, 18 months. That's it.
Thank you. Any board question?
A couple quick ones. I know we're pressed for time. I didn't notice that you said anything about possible biomass recovery in the forest lands. How we can help coordinate that with the water quality issues. Also, I was curious, I'll let you go ahead and answer that first. I do have another question.
Actually, we discussed that a little bit yesterday. It really hasn't been, you know, developed as an idea, but one of the things we talked about was in terms of fuel removal from riparian areas and how to do that in such a manner to protect water quality, but you also protect the riparian areas from fire. So we're going to go there.
Has there been an appropriate census taken as to how many stems of trees per acre that we have in the forest lands in this particular area, maybe even in the watershed? Have we done that?
I honestly don't know. Maybe I'm not understanding the question.
In terms of the number of trees per acre, mm-hmm. I use the word stems. But I have read in a couple of different areas where we probably have six times the number of trees that we've had historically. On average, maybe what historically has been 60 trees per acre, we're now averaging about 360 trees per acre. So my question to you would be, have we noticed or has there been any kind of account in the history of the Water Board as to the number of trees we have per acre, number one? Number two, is it of your opinion that the additional number of trees that we have per acre, does that have any kind of a significant impact on water temperature in the Shasta River?
Oh, boy. The answer to question one is I kind of doubt it. I really haven't seen anything like that. Haven't heard of anything like that with regard to the information that we have. With regard to the impact of you know, additional trees on the landscape versus historical, one can certainly surmise that there would be a benefit in that regard, depending on where those trees are. But I really don't have any information on it.
On the first part. Now, on the second question, in terms of having the additional number of trees, how does that impact, in your opinion, water temperature in the Shasta River?
Well, it really, really depends on placement. With regard to the Forest Service lands, it's in the upper areas you saw on the map there that David had. It's in the upland areas. Some of those areas do have water temperature issues, and obviously having more canopy and also the width of the riparian zone has a lot to do with the local microclimate and air temperature that can affect water temperature. So there are certainly areas that would benefit, you know, from more trees and produce cooler water temperatures down the line. I can't really quantify that.
Would it be a possibility to consider that the additional number of trees may have an impact on the quantity of water that's going into the tributaries?
There's some pretty complex relationships there, and while there can be impacts in terms of, you know, trees using water from that zone that is feeding the streams, there's also other effects that occur in terms of having trees in the floodplain with retention of soils, also retention of groundwater in the floodplain due to the fact that there is vegetation in the floodplain, which then contributes to longer baseline flows during the summer. So it's a complex relationship. It's really hard to answer on a broad basis.
Thank you.
Okay, any other board members have questions? Staff, do you want to ask staff questions? This is your perfect opportunity. Okay, thank you for your testimony. Caltrans, is there a representative from Caltrans? And our understanding is you're a former member of our staff?
Yes, I am.
And your assigned time is 10 minutes.
It'll be much less than that. Let me start by saying hello to Mr. Chairman, board members, staff, and members of the public. I'm going to give you a really brief summary of the actions that we've taken to comply with the Scott and Shasta River TMDLs and plans for the future. I should start off by saying that we operate under the general or the Caltrans stormwater permit that's been issued to us and our stormwater management plan. Under the requirements from the stormwater permit, we have completed a slope inventory on our roads, the one road there, which is State Route 3, and thus to determine the erosion and potential sediment transport. We have also completed a culvert inventory. We're going to be using this information in different ways. First, I need to discuss it with the other staff that make decisions. But the way I foresee using this information is for future road improvement projects in the vicinity where we have identified erosion issues. We want to bring to the forefront so they can add a component, erosion control component to that project. That's on the one hand. The other thing that we're going to be doing for the Scott River is I'll be dealing with our maintenance functional unit to discuss the areas that we have, to evaluate the information of where erosion is occurring so that we can decide projects for the stormwater crew that we have and maintenance functional unit. And they do small projects that are limited in scope, but at least that way we can start addressing some of the issues that have already been identified. Now, for the Shasta River, the one thing that we're working on right now, it's going to be dealing with the Lake Shastina and how the roads that roads and facilities that Caltrans has in that vicinity may be affecting the processes that are impacting low dissolved oxygen high temperatures in Lake Shastina. And what we're doing to that effect right now is we're looking at the studies we have already generated to determine stormwater runoff, and we're going to evaluate that information, identify the gaps, and just proceed with the conducting the study and then the plan to control any impacts that we might identify. And that's pretty much what I have. If you have any questions.
Do any board members have questions? I just had one. Is compliance with the TMDL a requirement of the general permit that you folks have?
Well, I think the general permit preceded the TMDL.
I know it did, but did it have a reference in there to...
I would have to go back and read it a little closer to know that.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments, Stan? Okay, thank you for your presentation.
Thank you.
The next is the City of Yreka. And you have 15 minutes.
Thank you. No, I think it's 8. No. Oh, yes. Yes.
Mr. Chairman and members of the board and members of the public, my name is Jeanette Hook. I'm the administrative assistant for the Department of Public Works for the City of Yreka. I could easily spend half an hour talking about the topic that Andy asked me to brief you on, but I will keep it brief in the interest of the other business that you have to consider this afternoon.
Thank you.
The City of Yreka is embarking on or has just completed approximately 8 projects that are directly related to water quality and stormwater management in the Yreka area. I'm going to only highlight about 3 of those projects. The map I just handed you is the project that I'll finish with, and that's our big $5 million stormwater grant from the state water boards. I do want to take the opportunity to say thank you very much to the state water boards and to you for that funding. It's absolutely critical. These projects could not happen in this community without grant funding. You've heard from a number of the agencies in this area that funding is absolutely vital. The projects that we have just either are embarking on or are in progress on, we have a Greenhorn Park floodplain restoration planning project, which is funded by the Fish and Wildlife Service and the Partners for Fish and Wildlife Program. We have an urban streams grant from the Department of Water Resources, which is acquiring some key pieces of property as well as partnering with our stormwater project. We're working on repairing the flood damages that we sustained at our wastewater treatment plant. That's approximately $600,000, and that's from FEMA. We're also working on a wastewater treatment plant expansion plan, which is also considering the possibility of relocating our facility. We've just completed a $1.5 million sewer rehabilitation project, which will directly contribute to reducing nitrogen and other nutrients affecting Yreka Creek. We have a $1.4 million grant from the Resources Agency for a River Parkways project. We have about approximately $81,000 from the Resource Advisory Committee to do an ecological stormwater mitigation plan. And then, as I alluded to, the $5 million that we received from the state water boards for our stormwater attenuation and floodplain restoration project. Thank you. Thanks to the vision of our Yreka Creek Advisory Committee, which is a completely ad hoc and informal group, and our past city councils, we've had a Greenway Master Plan in place for approximately 25 years. One of the reasons for our recent successes is that the money and the planning have finally come together in a convergence of opportunities. We're working on some salad here, and you've heard a lot about some tomatoes and radishes and carrots out there, and the lettuce is the part that's really driving this. So again, the lettuce, the salad, That's what's really needed to make these things happen. And these things can happen without additional regulation. It just takes the cooperation. This is an area that's rich in resources, but the economy does not follow suit with that analogy. So some of the plans that are specific to that Andy asked me to touch on is in regards to stormwater and the projects that are going on for the city. The Ecological Stormwater Mitigation Plan will take a look at the entire city and try to identify opportunities that we have to keep the watershed on the surface. The city of Wairika is a 150-year-old community. We have a number of areas of failing infrastructure, but we do have the opportunity to keep water on the surface because this community developed long before the infrastructure was being put underground. In cooperation with that, or as a part of that, we will be identifying a toolbox of best management practices that will help us achieve eventual MPDES MS4 compliance. We're inventorying and identifying those opportunities on both public and private property to use ecological opportunities or ecological treatments to increase infiltration, reduce sediments, and keep stormwater on the surface. We're also going to be developing plans for a small site demonstration project, which will actually be located at the Wairika High School, and that project will allow them to assist with water quality attainment, as well as provide an extremely incredible opportunity for education and providing that into the future, that stewardship experience into the for the future. The project will also develop a series of policy recommendations for the city and updating its stream protection and maintenance policies, again, for both public and private property. Our River Parkways project, which is at the north end of town, it will be affecting this reach of the stream. We'll be developing some trail resources and trying to get our public into appreciating the creek for what it is. We have some extensive riparian areas in that area, and we want to capitalize on that. We'll also acquire a couple of key pieces of property which are located down in this area. We do have some floodplain restoration activities planned in that project, but it will be somewhat limited due to the funding. We may be able to coordinate some of that restoration work with some FEMA hazard mitigation for our wastewater treatment plant. Our wastewater treatment plant, as you know, is located directly adjacent to Wairika Creek and did sustain quite a bit of damage in the floods that Mr. Joaquin referred to in 2005. And then finally, last but not least, I want to highlight for you my $5 million project. And this is near and dear to my heart because I'm the project coordinator for this particular project. It is simultaneously one of the most complex and one of the most simple projects I've ever worked on. All of the regulatory agencies are incredibly supportive, and we are very, very, very pleased to be able to report to you about this very cooperative and collaborative relationship that we are developing with the regulatory agencies. Every single one of them have been bent over backwards to assist this project, and it couldn't happen without that assistance. So I definitely want to acknowledge their support. I would also like to acknowledge the support and the assistance of your staff, in particular Dean Pratt in your 1600s office, and Kathleen Daly, who is our grant manager, and also Paul Kieran, who has been very, very helpful and very knowledgeable in providing guidance for us. The work of this project is coordinated with two or three other grants, besides the other two that I just mentioned, and it will accomplish some floodplain widening, and that floodplain widening will occur along Wairika Creek in these two locations. It's fairly small for this particular project, but we will also be working along Greenhorn Creek and restoring a portion of that. The project will also be doing some dredging at Greenhorn Reservoir. We anticipate recreating an additional approximately 25 acre feet of flood storage at Greenhorn Reservoir. We will also be installing upslope retention basins, which we anticipate will be storing approximately 31 acre feet, and allowing that water to meter itself out over several days past the peak flows. The intent of those basins are to take the peak off of storms, and so that our streets are not being needed for secondary conveyance of storm flows, which are then picking up all the attendant urban runoff problems. So we hope that those particular basins will positively affect Wairika Creek downstream. They are on unnamed tributaries with the exception of this one, which is the Little Humbug Creek, and it is it's an intermittent stream. We are also going to be installing the drained lines that exist in these locations down in this main part of town are approximately 30 inches. They need to be about 4 or 5 feet large. So we're going to be upsizing some significant chunks of our infrastructure. This is primarily an infrastructure project, but it does have some significant benefits in some of these other areas. When we do these drains, we are also going to be adding some hydrodynamic separators, which will assist in reducing sediment, removing gross debris, and if funding permits, we hope to add a filtration unit at the Center Street location, which will assist in removing hydrocarbons from the runoff that's coming through there. We have about 3 gas stations in that immediate vicinity. We do hope to have a dry year this year. I'm sure the rest of you don't, but because we have the deadlines of the funding on this project, we're going to be going into construction here in the next couple of months, and a dry year will greatly assist us in not impacting the creek in any negative ways. We have completed CEQA, and our permits are about ready to be issued. We do anticipate bidding on this project, or at least the first phase of it, in the next month or so. And we do need to get in and get the floodplain restoration work completed before October 15th, because we are going to need a temporary stream crossing, and NOAA Fisheries has asked us to make sure that crossing is out of the creek by October 15th so that we don't affect any of the runs this fall. In summary, we're solving real problems, and we're serving multiple purposes with this, and we're really excited about the opportunity and the chance to help the region achieve this more positive watershed stewardship. But we don't want to be forced into it. It's really not more regulation that's needed. It's a better application of what we do know. The more of the cooperative and mutually beneficial partnerships that you've heard about today, and of course, more money. Thank you. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Board members, do.
From your experience, is there anything that you believe could streamline the process even better for you?
Thank you for asking that. That's a great opportunity. We started this project knowing that it was, especially the stormwater project, knowing that it was under an extremely tight deadline. And we started it by sitting down with the regulatory agencies and saying, we can't do this if you aren't 100% behind us. And that sit-down discussion with them led into field trips with every single one of the regulatory agencies. Every one of the staff that is physically handling a permit or an application for us has been here, has seen it, and that in and of itself is so, so valuable. I cannot stress enough, if there are ways to streamline the project application process, the ITPs, any of those processes with a sit-down up front, I would highly, highly, highly recommend it.
What's your deadline on the FEMA?
On which?
On the FEMA grants. What's your deadline that you're working against?
I believe it's September 2009.
Thank you.
Any board member questions that come? Thank you. We appreciate your presentation. Sounds like you got a lot on your plate.
We do. Thank you.
Next we have regional board led actions, Brian McFadden and Andrew Baker. And if we can, before you begin, I want an update on when we have to vacate the building. Is that 5 or 6 o'clock?
When we're done and we'll pay overtime.
Okay.
Well, I don't want to lose the discipline of getting out of here. So if you can shorten it, I'd appreciate it.
All right. Well, I'm here to talk about some of the...
We've seen this before.
You haven't seen this part.
Okay.
If we go late enough in the day, maybe we won't notice.
He was the only alert one that caught.
Thank you, though. I'm going to talk about some of the actions in the Scott River Action Plan that that put our staff on the hook to deliver. And so these are things that come out of the Scott Action Plan, although at least one of them will apply to the Shasta as well. I'll briefly go through this to save time. The action plan requires that we review the relevant laws affecting suction dredging operations and investigate impacts by September 2009. And the status of that is that both the state board and the legislature are contemplating actions that would affect the regulation of that activity. And so we're following that process to determine how it will affect ours. Likewise, the action plan requires that we develop criteria for when we would request an erosion control plan or a riparian grazing management plan, and we're to do that by September 2008. At this time, we're collecting information and developing ideas about it, but it's in the formative stages. The action plan also requires that we develop a compliance and trend monitoring plan for the Scott River by this September, and we've begun work on that, and we'll have something to present to you this fall. Now I'm going to turn your attention to the outreach activities that we've been conducting in the two watersheds. And this is a list of organizations that we've been meeting with over the last year. What's not shown there is the multiple times that we've met with many of these organizations, and in particular the RCDs and the county we've met with on a regular basis. But I can say that we've met with some of the other agencies multiple times again. When we meet with them, we're basically discussing where they are in their process to comply with the TMDL, making sure that the expectations are understood, identifying any kind of situation that we could help to make sure that they're going to meet their obligations. And in the case of agencies that aren't obligated but can help, we're trying to coordinate our activities and find opportunities so that we can work together most effectively. And that's led to, on average, at least one staff person up here 1 or 2 weeks out of the month. Most often it's Andy and myself traveling together, but periodically we have 5 or 6 of us come up, including members of the upper management staff and our executive officer. And those meetings have been really fruitful. Now I'd like to turn your attention to Moffett Creek, which is a tributary to the Scott River. It's a sub-basin where it's been identified as having really high turbidities that not only make the Moffett Creek quite muddy, turbid, but it affects the turbidity of the Scott River all the way downstream to the Klamath and then on to the Klamath, where it can really discolor the Klamath. And we've been told by Dr. Mike Diaz that that also affects primary production, photosynthesis, and those basic types of water quality processes. And so it's of interest to us on a scale greater than just Moffett Creek. Likewise, there's also been unpermitted activities occurring in the basin that we've gotten complaints about, and as part of our effort here, we're trying to make known the responsibilities individuals have before they take a bulldozer into the creek. to help us with that, we've developed a contract with the RCD, the Siskiyou RCD. It's a very small contract, but we feel like we're getting a lot out of it because they've been able to help us reach out to the landowners and get the word out in a way that we can't about the need for this sub-basin to take on these issues in a comprehensive way. And we've had three public meetings to date, and RCD has developed an informational brochure to help us with that so that that brochure would be able to get the information in a succinct way to people who need to know what permits they need for any given activity and who are the contacts. And to date, there's a landowner group forming in the sub-basin, and we're happy with the progress. Another thing that we've been working on are our landowner letters. It's our intent to send letters to every landowner in both the Scott and Shasta watersheds to inform them of what the water quality requirements are now with the TMDL. And we've drafted these letters, shared them with the RCDs and SOSS, and met with them, and they've given us some constructive comments on how we can craft the letter so it's most effective in reaching out to these people and gets a response that isn't akin to a hostile response. And at this point, we're redrafting those letters and developing a frequently asked questions document for each watershed. That was a suggestion that we got from the RCDs and the SOSS. And we're going forward with that. The last item I'm going to tell you about are the public presentations that we've been doing to get the word out about both the work that needs to be done and the work that we have done and understandings that we've developed. We've made presentations at a number of conferences and to the National Academy of Sciences. And we're presenting this information at this meeting, and we intend to keep doing that on a regular basis for you and the public. And so that's all I have for you. If you have questions for me, I'd be happy to answer them.
Do board members have questions?
Board member Rams. In terms of the landowner letter, what, are we under some requirement to inform them and we're fulfilling that requirement, or what? Or we're just putting people on notice that they should be on notice that there are these things that they're required to do?
I don't think there's any statutory obligation for us to do that, but it seems prudent for us to make known what those new requirements are, and then also some of the old requirements that, such as 401 certification, that are not well known in either of these two valleys. In some ways, putting people on notice.
I guess I'm just struck by the tone of cooperation that I've heard and the activity and the involvement of landowner groups, and it strikes me as a dumb idea to send a letter from the regional board saying, here's a bunch of requirements.
I think we're modeling it after what Department of Fish and Game did. One concern is that the RCDs are able to get some folks, but some of the folks who are most prone to have bulldozers in the creek may not be coming to the RCD meetings.
Yeah, but I mean, I don't think you're beholden to use an RCD database, but the letterhead is pretty useful.
Any other board member questions or comments? Does staff want to ask staff? Okay. Then have we covered the... Andrew Baker, are you going to have additional on the grant projects or response to complaints?
Yeah, very briefly. Okay. Yeah, we're almost done. I'm going to update you on the grant projects and our approach to responding to complaints, and then we're going to give you a preview of the board tour tomorrow. You've already heard about all but one of these grant projects. There's a lot of money being funneled into the watersheds for restoration, fish and game grants, NOAA Fisheries, Fish and Wildlife, Nature Conservancy, and others. And then we have our own grant program. As you heard from the city of Wairika, we have awarded them $5 million for their stormwater attenuation floodplain restoration project. The Shasta Valley RCD was awarded $635,000 for dam removal and refit project that Dave Webb had told you about. Another project the Shasta Valley RCD has is dam removal and tailwater reduction project with demonstration projects for over $735,000. One you haven't heard about is the Scott River Sediment Source Reduction Project. That's a sediment reduction project on Forest Service roads, and that is for over $251,000. So I'm going to give you a brief overview of our complaint investigation. As you know, we get a lot of complaints in our office from the public, environmental groups, tribes, other agencies, and our own staff just driving around the region seeing problems. So as you know, we have a number of enforcement tools to use. We use our progressive enforcement, where we start with just working with the landowner, trying to work things out. And the vast majority of the time, that's how we handle things. You probably never hear about them because we're just handling them as staff. In some situations, we have to take more aggressive approach. So in the Scott watershed, since TMDLs were adopted, we've investigated 13 complaints and 10 in the Shasta watershed. And all these complaints except one were handled by verbal agreement. We refer people to the RCDs, NRCS, Natural Resource Conservation Service, or others for assistance, or, you know, some of them are very simple. Just, you know, trying to keep cows away from creeks and protecting the creeks. We've had, you know, like I said, very good cooperation in the watersheds. There was one case recently in the Shasta watershed where someone went in with an excavator and excavated approximately 1 mile of stream. This was a small perennial fish stream with associated habitat, wetland habitat, and in that case we issued a cleanup and abatement order and are requiring a stream restoration plan and implementation of the plan. And so far we met with the responsible parties last week, and they have agreed to cooperate and implement the cleanup and abatement order. So before I continue on with the tour, are there any questions?
Okay, tour announcements.
Here's a contorted map of it looks a little stretched out here, but the tour will begin in Mount Shasta City at the Treehouse Motel, and from there we're going to go to an overlook on Parks Creek near the I-5 rest stop and Porky Bob's hamburger stand, and we're going to get a presentation on the geology of the Shasta Valley by Bill Hurt, who is a geology professor at the local college, and he's also on the Shasta Valley RCD board. from there, we'll continue on to Dwinnell Dam and the Monongahela Water Conservation District. Will give us a presentation there. So from there, we're going to make a brief stop at Stan Sears' ranch. We're not going to get off the bus, but Stan has offered to give us an explanation and tell us about his tailwater reduction plan and other projects on his ranch. From there, we go to Don Gamber's ranch, and Don's going to tell us about all the wonderful things that he's been doing on his ranch. So I just want to say that I don't know what the weather forecast is, but sometimes you do get rain up here, and it's been very hot. So dress appropriately. We're going to do a little bit of hiking, so bring your walking and hiking shoes. And everybody should be prepared to bring their own food and water. We will have some water available. The other thing is we're going to be picking people up in Wairika at the Walmart parking lot. The bus is going to depart at 7:30 for the people in Wairika, and then we're going to drop them off after the tour, after we drop people off in Mount Shasta City. So our friends from the California Highway Patrol will be accompanying us to take care of highway safety or other safety issues that might arise. And that's about it, except that Brian's going to tell you about the Scott part of the tour.
I had one question of clarification. I had been given different time for the Wairika pickup, so can you state exactly what time the pickup will be?
7:30.
Okay.
It's going to depart at 7:30.
And everybody agrees it's 7:30, not 7 a.m.? Okay.
Isn't it
7 a.m.? And we're going to be boarding in Mount Shasta at 8:30, so that gives plenty of time for the bus to get from.
Yeah, no, I just have been given a different time to announce, and I just wanted to make sure we had it right.
Another stop I didn't mention is lunch. We're going to have lunch at the Siskiyou County Museum in Wairika. So.
And then, from there, we're going to go over Forest Mountain into Scott Valley and stop at the base of the mountain where Moffat Creek enters Scott Valley, which happens to be where Highway 3 enters Scott Valley, and get out and have a discussion about Moffat Creek, the activities that have been going on, and our outreach and the challenges. Moffat Creek really does present some challenges, and we'll discuss all those. From there, we will pass through Fort Jones and sort of snake our way through Scott Valley, crossing over the river in a number of places, and until we get to Etna, where we'll have a bathroom break, and then continue on to French Creek, where the RCD is going to be giving us a presentation about some of their work. And following that, we will cross back over the Scott River over to the east side road and travel east side road on to Callahan, where we'll all get a real good eyeful of the Scott River dredge tailings, which are a prominent feature in that landscape and also present a challenge to water quality and watershed restoration, and head over the hill through Gazelle and back to Wheat, part of Mount Shasta.
Thank you. Any board member questions? Staff questions? Okay, thank you. That brings to Kat. If you have any...
I'll just skip the wrap-up. I think we have... if there are any public comments, I guess is all that's left.
Okay. With that, I have for public comment Fleche Pace.
Fleche.
I don't have another. Oh, yes, I do. And Regina Ciccozzolo. Yeah, I'm sorry.
Jean.
Thank you. Oh. Okay.
Well,
and we'll call on.
You're also a public. Thank
you so much for coming up here. My name is Marsha Armstrong, and I'm the 5th District Supervisor of Siskiyou County. I was interested today in listening to someone say that the coho will be better off at the end of the permit period. I hope to God that farmers and ranchers will be better off by that period of time. I recently testified at the Senate Natural Resources and Water Committee on the economic impact of regulations on Siskiyou County, and it has not been good. We're about to lose our mining industry. We've lost a substantial amount of our timber industry, and we've lost some of our farming industry up in the Tule Lake area. We are struggling to survive here against regulations. One of the strategies that we've used is this collaborative approach, and it's been very successful. People are frightened that they're going to lose their way of living. They're small family farmers, and this has been a strategy that's worked for us. You get your compliance, we get to survive. It's been a good bargain. I'm very wary of this new sediment set of regulations that you're proposing. It looks like it will control everything that we do on the land with a permit, particularly farming and ranching. As you see today, we have a set of incidental take permit. We have the 1603. Now we have the TMBLs. We have the Section 404s. We have all of these permits on top of permits. We haven't even started the federal incidental take permit process. It's very difficult for these small family farmers to comply and even pay the permit. The permits are not, we're still waiting in our road department for some permits on FEMA work that we needed to do post-flood. So it's not a speedy process, and it's not a cheap process, and the CEQA is very expensive. And anything that you can do to help fold your processes into what we're already doing and add it onto the list of things that we need to comply so we have one stop. Anything that you can do to make it cheaper for people and easier to comply. I want to thank Brian McFadden from your staff for finding some money for us for our groundwater study. We don't have the resources to do these kinds of things. We want to comply. We want to get the same results that you want, but we need to survive too. And anything you can do to help us will be appreciated. Thank you.
Any board member questions? Any staff questions? No. Thank you, sir.
J. Pace, representing myself. I want to begin by commending the good work of the restorationists, particularly the stars of the restoration crew up here, Dave Webb, Gary Black, Danielle Quigley, and there are others, but those are the main ones. But also those landowners who have been proactive. And I want to recognize the fact that there are landowners that did all the stuff before there were any of these programs. They did it just on their own, and we never hear about them. And the collaborative process is very, very appropriate for those landowners who are proactive. However, there are landowners out there who are the bad actors, and I have a problem personally with protecting them. For example, the Moffett Creek bulldozing that occurred this year, running bulldozers in Moffett Creek, the decision by the executive officer to handle that in a collaborative fashion and not cite this person encourages other people to do the same thing. So yesterday I observed right below the farmer's ditch in Scott Valley an excavator removing the banks of the stream, and the loader and the dump trucks running in the bed of the stream, and I just hand wrote a complaint on that. And if that person in Moffett Creek or persons in Moffett Creek who had done this before rode their bulldozers in the creek had been cited instead of collaborated with, I think that person who is responsible for the one I observed yesterday might not have done it. So, this is supposed to be a regulatory agency, not just a cheerleading agency. Mr. Dupre, in terms of the groundwater study, said that the board has requested that, and I think the executive officer said it was required, and I would like to ask the board, I'm a little confused, is it is the groundwater study required or is it optional?
It's required.
Scope of work is required.
Well, I was asking the board, actually. The chair can answer.
I did.
Okay, great. Siskiyou County's position is that Siskiyou County is in charge of groundwater and wants to be in control of any groundwater studies. $85,000 has been provided for just development of the study plan. And there's some significant administrative costs in there too, in addition to the money going to the professor. Being done through a board that's appointed by the Board of Supervisors, which is the RCD boards. There's two issues here. One is control selection of who develops the study plan and control of the study itself. And if the North Coast Water Quality Board is paying, then why doesn't the North Coast Water Quality Board have control of the study? Siskiyou wants control. They should put up the money. Now, we've just heard how they don't have the money. And 60% of the land in Siskiyou County, I lived here since 1975, by the way, 60% is federal land. That's true. But this county is about the size of New Jersey. That means that the 40% that's private land is about the size of Rhode Island. So there is a considerable tax base in this county. Also, the county seems to have money for a host of lawyers. They're external counsels. They cost a lot of money to attend, to negotiate ITPs with the Department of Fish and Game, and so forth and so on. The landowners have enough money to have a staff from SOSS here and to have lawyers on the staff of SOSS. So I just don't buy that this county doesn't have any money and needs $85,000 from the North Coast Water Board. But that's not the primary problem. If we had all this money, who cares who pays as long as the work gets done, right? But there are opportunity costs. At the same time that this is happening, the North Coast Water Quality Control Board told the EPA they could not complete the Lost River TMDL. That means we won't have a basin plan amendment, we won't have an implementation plan. The Lost River empties after it's pumped through Sheepy Ridge into the Straits drain, the Klamath Straits. It's not a drain, it's actually a natural water body once upon a time. Into the Klamath Straits, the water quality is so bad that at times it discharges pure ammonia into the Klamath River, in that section of the Klamath River, which has fish kills on a regular basis. So, you know, there are opportunity costs. I'm an economist, not a scientist, and economists use this term, and if anybody needs an explanation, it means basically that if you're spending your money on a car, you know, you're not going to have it to spend on a house. Okay, so there are opportunity costs when we do these things. And I just wanted to make sure the board was aware of that. The Fish and Game came up and presented on the proposed ITPs. Department of Fish and Game has used salmon restoration funds to fund the RCDs to develop the capacity to administer these ITPs. This is a violation not only of agreements with the National Marine Fisheries Service, but also the intent of the legislature, which is that, I'm told by legislators, is that restoration funds won't be used for regulatory compliance. If we use all our restoration funds for regulatory compliance, we will not ever get to restoration. So, I know it's late, and I'm falling asleep too and getting fired of this. And getting... So I guess I'll skip a whole bunch of stuff, but I wanted to make you aware that the counties, if the Fish and Game is not going to implement the law in Siskiyou County, and basically they've gone along with navigability being abolished, they've gone along with their own ability to regulate and have access to the land being abolished by the landowners of Siskiyou County, abetted by the county. And so maybe we ought to just pull the agencies out. Oh, another opportunity cost, by the way. I remember earlier this morning we were talking about $12,000 as the cost of having an office up here so we could have better service. And but we got $85,000 to develop a study plan. Not to do the study, to develop the study plan. Something seems wrong in that picture to me. I think the other thing that's going on that you may not be aware of is that the counties up here and the California Farm Bureau Federation are making moves to take over Water Master Service from the state. There has been a court order in MoDoc County where they started, and according to what I read, they're planning to move forward with that. So maybe we can pull DWR out too, and just not have the agencies here because they're, as far as I can tell, not doing their job. So in conclusion, I guess there really are sacred cows. There are those who are state agencies and bend over backwards to provide for, and there are others who have to play by the rules and pay the fees. And I don't understand why it's okay for some people in this room, some of the regulated community, to have to pay their own permit fees and others to get funded and have to pay for their own compliance and others to get funded in order to comply. I just can't get used to that idea, and it just doesn't seem right to me in a democracy that we have that kind of situation. We have the de facto abolishment of navigability of the Shasta and Scott, including successfully denying fish and game access that they have a right to. We have the abolishment of the fish and game codes. We wouldn't need flow studies and groundwater studies and all that if 5938, fish and game code 5938, was enforced. We have abolishment of North Coast Water Quality Control Board enforcement when bulldozers bulldoze the creek. I hate to end on a bad note, so I will go back to what I started with. There are really good actors out there. There are people who don't ask for anything in order to do what they consider to be their responsibility under law and as stewards of the land. And these people never get any help. It seems like the people that get, what we are doing is we are reinforcing bad actors. And I think that is counterproductive and undermines the authority, the legitimate authority of government. Thank you.
I don't believe, is there anybody else from the public to speak? Otherwise, we will go to our executive director for a wrap-up, and then very quickly to the board, and then on to the settlement.
I'd just like to wrap this up and thank staff and thank all the presenters who spent quite a bit of time preparing for today. I know it ended up being long. I think it was a good dialogue. I think the importance of is to continue the dialogue, and like to just as staff emphasize the importance of running up and preparing for this meeting. We had a lot of really good conversations with everybody from Felice to SOSS to the county, and having these kinds of format, from my view, and I hope the board feels as well, are important to keep us on track. We've got some deadlines we need to meet in implementing these TMDLs, and it keeps us on track making those deadlines and making our commitment that we've made to the public.
I'll take it to board members. Board member comments?
Mr. Chairman, I want to first thank everyone. At my very first meeting back in this November of last year, I invited you and the staff to come up here to Wairika because it had been a number of years since there was a full board meeting. And I want to thank all of you for agreeing to come up here and at least hearing from the good people of this county and to hear their stories, how they're trying to collaborate and comply with the regulations despite some unsubstantiated allegations to the contrary. And I would like to add that the folks of Siskiyou really want to do what's right. And if a lot of folks had their way up here, they'd have their own state. But as some of you may have noticed coming in, the state of Jefferson Barn, just south of Wairika. But I will say that everyone's trying to do their best. And despite the fact that we may have a couple of bad apples, certainly outreach and education is going to help to alleviate some of the actions of those that may give the good people of Siskiyou County a bad name. So on that note, again, I want to welcome all of you to Siskiyou County, and thanks for coming, and look forward to the bus tour tomorrow.
Any other board members' comments? I just want to thank you for inviting us. I think these presentations are very educational, and they give a feel for the size and scope of what programs are going on. I appreciate it. The next agenda item is going